Welcome to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring Coast to Coast AM from June 28, 1996.
From the high desert and the great American Southwest, I bid you all good evening, good morning, as the moon pulls full this weekend. From the Hawaiian and Tahitian island chains, eastward to the Caribbean and the U.S. Virgin Islands, south into South America, north to the pole, and worldwide on the internet, this is Coast to Coast AM. And a lot of you have been asking for him. I've received fax after fax and phone call and email, and where is Jim Berkland? Well, that's who I've got for you tonight, Jim Berkland. He is a California geologist. Actually, a fascinating guy. And I'm going to read you the facts that I received, the email, actually, last night from Jim. Art, I would be pleased to be on your show anytime. This summer can't miss for the West Coast terrestrial tingles. That's in quotes, terrestrial tingles. The word earthquake frightens, he says, some people enough so they wanted me fired after naming and predicting the World Series quake. I was allowed to return to my job as county geologist after 2.5 months of suspension after promising, quote, not to predict any more earthquakes on county time, end quote. We'll find out whether he's on county time right now in a minute. That's when I began my monthly newsletter. He is a fascinating guy, a geologist, a predictor of earthquakes. He is Jim Berkland, and I'll tell you something, folks. We are entering a particularly interesting time in about an hour. I think it's in about an hour. Jim will tell you all about it. So coming up in a moment, Jim Berkland, geologist extraordinaire. A couple of little announcements here. One, everybody's been asking to see a photograph of my crazy wild cat Comet. Comet, in what we call the pinky slink position, is now to be viewed on my webpage as of about an hour ago. Comet's picture, for the first time, is up there. So those of you who wanted to see Comet, there you go. In addition, on my webpage, I'm going to give you two reasons to go to the webpage tonight. Though Jim Berkland does not have a webpage of his own, my webmaster, Keith Rowland, has located several references to Jim Berkland in earthquake areas of the internet, and there are appropriate links up there now. So if you want to find out more about Jim Berkland, you can do that also on the webpage. So my cat Comet and Jim Berkland, not necessarily in that order, up on my webpage, which is www.artbell.com. Easy. www.artbell.com. James Berkland. I have in front of me the Who's Who in Science and Engineering Third Edition Award given to James Berkland. And those included in this award, those limited to receiving this award are those individuals who have demonstrated outstanding achievement in their own fields of endeavor and who have thereby contributed significantly to the betterment of contemporary society. The Marquis Who's Who Award. Now, I wonder if his earthquake predictions got him there. I've got a number of, he faxed me zillions of pages today of California headline stuff. For example, Gilroy, the Dispatch, a 7.0 monster, it says, back on October 18th of 89. Geologist is on the money, the story says. Jim Berkland would rather have been wrong, but Tuesday's quake made true his prediction, measuring 3.5 to 6.0 on the Richter scale. So Jim called that one. Or this newspaper headline: California geologist was right on the money with his prediction, and this is the Seattle Times. He's too dignified to say, I told you so, but California geologist Jim Berkland did indeed tell us so, and he's got video to prove it. That's the beginning of the article. Or this one from the Times Tribune. Birkeland scores again on quake. Earthquake predictor Jim Birkeland has scored again, the Santa Clara County geologist who gained notoriety for his World Series earthquake. Called for an earthquake of between 3.5 and 5.5 to hit within 70 miles of San Jose January 9th and or through the 16th, I believe, and sure enough, 4.2 January 12th, 68 miles south of San Jose. And on and on and on it goes. And the secret, he says, is syzygy. His name is harder to say than Marcesa. I guess that's his name. Nobody could get it right. There's about 25 ways of pronouncing it. How do you pronounce S-Y-Z-Y-G-Y? What kind of word is that? Jim Birkeland, hello.
Hello, Art. It's from the Greek, zygos, meaning yoked together like a team of oxen.
Well, let me hear you pronounce it.
Syzygy.
Syzygy. Oh, it sounds like there's an R in there.
Well, it shouldn't. Syzygy.
Syzygy.
Unless you have from New York, you might say a little R. But actually, I put it phonetically on the header of my newsletter so that people, first time through, they often pick it up. Syzygy. And when I went to get that for my license plate, a personalized license plate,
yes,
they said, now, what does that mean? You know, really accusatory, something evil.
Something nasty.
And I said, well, I explained it's the sun, moon, and earth lining up twice a month at new and full moon times. And she said, well, before you get it, you better check the big book and see if anybody else has it. And I said, are you kidding? Well, I went to the big book, and there were 15 people that beat me to it.
So you would have to be syzygy number 16.
Well, I had syzygy Q. It sounds a little like Suzy Q, and it also syzygy then quake.
How about syzygy O for original?
Well, but syzygy quake is a little more fitting, I think.
All right. Well,
I had it on my car for about 2 weeks, and all of a sudden the cop pulled me over, and I thought, now what have I done? And he said, I just had to know what that meant.
Uh-huh. Oh, really?
Yes.
And so you told him, you explained
it. Oh, sure,
it
yeah. That was the only reason he stopped me.
All right. Look, a couple of days ago, this is no kidding because I read it on the air, so it's documented in my tape replays. I began to get faxes from people, Jim, saying, hey, Art, have you noticed people being on edge? Have you noticed people being weirded out in the last couple of days? We're building towards something. Other people sending faxes saying the hair on the back of my neck is standing up. People are beginning to feel something, Jim, you know, like something is upon us.
This is similar to reports I've had many times in the past, and I have been getting half a dozen in the last week. I think there is something to it. I had my own transient, an ocular transient. We get the zigzag lines, almost like I had my own seismogram inside my head, and lost visual acuity there for about 20 minutes. I had before... I've never related it to earthquakes before, but I'm going to pay attention to what happens in the next few days, very much so.
All right. You are, just so that everybody knows, you are now on county time, right?
Oh, no, no. I retired. I retired from the county, so I'm free as a bird.
Oh, you really are then.
What I want without fear of censorship.
So now is the time when you can say about your old boss everything you ever wanted to say.
Yes, I told him he's going to have a prominent role in my book.
Is that right? Uh-huh. Who exactly did you work for, Jim?
I worked for the County of Santa Clara as their first and only county geologist for 21 years.
21 years.
And then in 1989, 1 week exactly after the World Series earthquake, they called me into a person-to-person conference, and they said, Jim, because of your recent pronouncements, I'm very troubled. I want you to go home for a few days and not speak to the media about earthquakes.
I know. What had you done? First of all, take me back before that event. I mean, somehow you predicted this earthquake.
Along with many, many others since 1974.
Yes.
And so, you know.
But, I mean, you went to the press, or how'd you get the information?
Well, in most cases, the press came to me. In this case, things were piling up to such a degree I had to get the word out because I felt that people needed to be informed, just like if you saw some funnel clouds beginning to drop.
Yes.
And we had things like deer clustering around a house with a whole herd of deer coming to, without fear of people.
Huh.
We had a little hamster that was very friendly, suddenly bites its, the hand that fed it.
Really?
And we had seagulls lining up in parks like troops on parade.
Really?
And row and file, rank and file.
Now, you also follow lost dog reports, don't you?
Very, very much so. That was introduced to me back in 1979 by a physicist with Xerox who called me up while I was home eating, and he said, Mr. Berglund, you know, I've been following your predictions, and I agree with you with your upcoming seismic window because the cats are disappearing again.
Huh.
And I said, what? He said, yes, I look at the lost and found column in the local paper, and I see it lengthens just before local quakes. Well, I almost hung up on him, because I'm a scientist, you know, and this was so outlandish, and I've weathered many outlandish ideas and suggestions from others. But this one threw me until suddenly, it's like I really had that light bulb sort of appear over my head. Our cat, Rocky, had disappeared 6 days before the strongest quake since 1911, and I hadn't associated him disappearing with the earthquake that followed, the 5.9, on August 6, 1979. But I had mailed on August 2nd a letter to the U.S. Geological Survey in Denver predicting that between the 7th and 14th we would have such a quake.
Did you get an answer?
Oh, they, yes. But when they said, Jim, we've just looked at your first 5 years of predictions and you hit the 99 percentile level. There's only one chance in 100. What you've been doing is accidental, but we think you've been lucky.
Lucky?
Yes.
Lucky?
Yes. And then they said, if you tell some media person I told you this, I'll deny it. And he has been true to his word. And I didn't get it in writing, but when they issued their final report on this, so they were taking predictions from numerologists and astrologers and dreamers and anyone that wanted to file a prediction. And when they came out with their final report, they said no one achieved the required 99 percentile level, and no scientist even bothered to submit a prediction. So
ooh.
I called them up immediately, and I said, I'm not chopped liver. I'm a fellow in the Geological Society and a member of half a dozen other scientific groups. I've published more than 50 scientific papers, so I am a scientist. And he said, well, what I really meant to say was that an insufficient number of scientists had filed predictions to make it statistically meaningful. Well, that's a little different.
I see.
But he never changed it in his final report. And they've done this time after time, and that's why in this month's newsletter I've just stopped being on the defensive. I've gotten offensive and said, if they're so damn good, what's their record?
Well, that's a good question, actually. Do they have one? Has USGS ever indulged in official prediction? And if so, what is their record?
On less frequent occasions lately, they have at least 12 on record, and they've missed all of them.
All of them?
Yes.
Well, that's not very impressive.
Well, it's pretty sad. In fact, their most prominent one was the Parkfield experiment, in which they had a 95% chance.
I remember that. What a flop.
Yeah, for a 6 magnitude or better to hit by the end of 1992. And it still has not happened. And that almost was the end of the USGS. They almost lost their funding a couple of years ago with this, what I call the contraction of America.
Well, so you either would go to the press, or the press would more likely come to you,
yes,
and say, what's going on?
Yep.
And so you knew this quake was coming somehow.
Oh, yes. Well, we had the highest tidal force in 3 years on October 14th, 1989. We had the full moon and the closest approach of the moon in 3 years, only 3 hours apart. And the exact same thing happened back in 1865 on October 4th. And October 8th of 1865, a 7-magnitude quake hit the San Andreas Fault near Loma Prieta. And so with the same conditions developing, I could see the probabilities were there at the start of the year, and I issued a little pamphlet saying that between the 14th and 21st, there was an 80% chance that there would be a 3.5 to 6-magnitude quake, or 5.5-magnitude at the top. And then just before that critical period, instead of seeing 4 or 5 missing cats in the paper, there were 27. I mean, it was a whole different universe looking in there. Instead of, you know, a 3-inch column of lost and found, it was 12 inches long.
Hey, these are cats that disappear, just to dwell on this for a second. What about cats that are house cats that cannot disappear? Do people notice differences in their behavior?
Oh, sure. They'll do things. They'll not eat their favorite food. They will follow you around the house as if they don't want you out of their sight, or they will demand to get outside, and you'll open the door, and they won't go out. They'll expect you to go out with them. One case, a cat got on the favorite armchair of the owner and the cat had been forbidden to get on that chair. It got up on top as if on a mountain peak and let out a big yodel. They'd never heard such a sound come out of this cat in 5 years.
A yodel.
4 hours later, we had a 4.4 quake, the strongest in about a year in the area. And
how do you think, this is a silly question, of course, but how do you think these animals are feeling this?
Well, I think they rely upon the Earth's magnetic field for navigation.
Right.
And that's how these dogs and cats will come 1,000 miles home, you know. You take them away and they come back. That's not magic. And that's how the whales and dolphins travel and migrate thousands of miles north-south up along the Pacific coast, you know. In fact, Dr. Kirschvink at UCLA has his hypothesis is that they travel in magnetic troughs. And if you just follow that up, you say, aha. If this magnetic trough, which is going mainly north-south, should be diverted, it should get anomalous and lead onto a beach, then up come the whales and the dolphins and beach themselves. And if you go out and turn them around, they come back up again.
They come right back. That's true.
Yeah. We had Humphrey in the bay. The last time he came into San Francisco Bay was in October of 1990.
Mm-hmm.
And he got stuck on the mud at Candlestick Park, and they spent a couple of days keeping him wet and throwing lines around, and finally towed him off, and the beautiful picture of him waving his flukes goodbye to San Francisco, going down the Golden Gate.
Yeah.
Well, did you notice in the column right next to his picture in several papers, 5.8 quake shakes the Bay Area.
Yep.
He got disoriented, as animals will, before earthquakes. I have many, many reports of homing pigeons losing their way prior to significant quakes in the local area. They fly over the fault line that's under disturbance, and they get them disoriented.
All right. We are not as much in touch with these primitive, I think they're primitive, senses that animals have, but we too are animals, and so people, some people anyway, feel these things, don't they?
Yes, and it's funny, I used to find it much easier to accept that animals could detect these things, and then I started getting calls from people, especially the people with headaches. Now, 9 separate people have called me, and they say, well, we've heard you do with animals, but, you know, don't let this get around. But I get these terrible headaches, and they start 3 or 4 days in advance of a local quake, and I tell my family about it, and they laugh and, then, you know, make fun of me.
Mm-hmm.
And then just a few hours or a few minutes before the quake itself, the pain and pressure disappear, and that's when I know the quake is imminent. I get the same story again and again, and the first 2 such stories came. First one in 1982, and the next one in 1986. And in between, exactly halfway between, there was a meeting of the American Geophysical Union in San Francisco, and they announced for the first time the discovery of the mineral magnetite in the human body. And it's right between the eyebrows where this pain, this headache is centered. And that's where the pineal gland is, and that's where the mystical third eye is supposed to be. And where the Indian ladies paint the red spot. There's a lot going on there that we don't understand, but some people are still attuned in with their primitive sense.
Ooh, that's fascinating.
Yeah.
I never thought about that red spot that Indian girls.
Mm-hmm.
That's true. Now, we're not going to have time for it because we're coming to the bottom of the hour, but one very special reason I had you on tonight is because we're at a very strange moment, aren't we?
The window's about to open. The best seismic window of the year. If you're looking on behalf of earthquakes, you know, but the clearest seismic window of the year. We're having the blue moon on the 30th,
yes,
which is the second full moon in a single month, and it's only 18 hours away from the closest approach of the moon for the last 6 months.
18 hours.
And this is producing tides all up and down the coast that'll be the highest of the year. And the tide changes from high to low in just a 6-hour period.
Mm-hmm.
And as this water comes sweeping up the estuaries and the bays, each foot of water weighs nearly 1 million tons per square mile.
All right.
So calculate the square miles and look at that load that old Mother Earth has to endure, and she will occasionally slip a disc.
All right. Well, we'll talk about slipping discs in a moment. Relax for a few, and we'll be right back to you. That's why he's here. That's why Jim Berkland is here. A retired California geologist, and he'll tell you about this window that we're moving into right now. Beginning in about a half hour, we're moving into this window.
This is Premier Networks. That was Art Bell hosting Coast to Coast AM on this Somewhere in Time. listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring Coast to Coast AM from the 28th of June of 1996.
My guest is retired California geologist Jim Berkland. Many of you know him, many of you don't. Listen carefully, you'll find out about him. Back to him in a moment. Back now to Jim Berkland. Jim.
Yes, sir.
So we're in this window. How frequently do we get in a window of this clarity?
No more than five times a year that you have a syzygy and a close approach or perigee on the same day, as few as two times a year. But to get them only a few hours apart is about a once a year occurrence. This is about about once a year. Then the tides only give you an idea as to when. For any real earthquake prediction, you need to have when, where, how big, and you should give probability.
Mm-hmm.
So we link the when in many cases with the tides. So as to the where and how big, you rely upon the local effects. We know what the tides are going to be years ahead of time. So then, as we approach those critical periods, we should look at the animals, the water levels. You know, your water well may turn Artesian just before quake.
Really?
It may change its temperature, yeah. Change its water quality. Smell like rotten eggs. Get turbid.
You know, I had a fellow years ago who called my show who used to measure some sort of radiation that was coming.
Radon gas.
Radon gas, yeah.
Yes.
He measured radon gas. He used to call my program, and with eerie accuracy,
yes,
he was predicting earthquakes.
I'm afraid so. And they even detected it in the spring water in Japan before the big quake there in January 17th
I recall,
of last year, on
yes,
the day of the full moon in January of 95. And the reports finally began to gather. They wanted one way to check on the old water, but they hadn't been doing it, see, monitoring it. So they just got the bottled water that had dates on it, uncapped it, and analyzed each bottle in sequence and found the radon peaked out about a week before the big quake.
So there is something to that.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Right.
That's one of some 50 clues that have been used at various times by various people.
So the sun causing a great disturbance in the upper atmosphere might also affect things.
Oh, gosh, yes.
And then they've been also talking about a connection lately, a geological connection to, I know it sounds strange, but to the upper atmosphere, and they've been tracking these pulses of energy that go way out into the upper atmosphere during a lightning storm. It's really weird.
Mm.
I guess you've heard some about that.
And from the space shuttle, the photographs there are incredible.
That's right,
yeah.
Yes. Uh-huh. So there's a lot about gravity that we just plain don't understand.
When Newton had the apple hit him on the head, they said it was an apple. I said, well, I really always thought it was a fig because we've all heard of a fig Newton. And then people said, well, now they make apple Newton, so it spoiled my story.
So you use almost 50 different data points?
Well, there's that many available. I use four or five.
Four or five.
And even, I must admit, as a scientist, there are some psychics that have the ability to predict earthquakes.
Yes.
And just because we don't have the explanation for it now, that doesn't mean it's not science.
That's true. You know, of course, of Gordon Michael Scallion.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
And others who do it and do it fairly reliably. What, over the years, would you say you can document your accuracy rating to be?
At least 75%. Back in 1985, it was as high as 83%. And then people kind of said, well, Jim, you're only giving us four or five or six seismic windows per year, and I want to plan this trip or plan washing the upper windows of my two-story apartment or something. What's happening next month? So mm-hmm. I began to give the best window for each month. And so I don't just deal with the cream at the top.
Yes.
I deal with the best window of each month, and that has made my average drop.
However, we happen to be at the cream of the crop.
Oh, yes, this time.
When does that officially begin?
Midnight.
At midnight tonight, huh?
Our time here. My window runs from midnight tonight to midnight on the 6th of July. An eight-day window, it always is. It usually opens the day before the newer full moon, but it can open up to 3 days before, depending on what the tides show me. So if anyone gets hold of the latest 1996 dot tide book that goes free at the sporting goods stores,
yes,
they'll see a couple of pages about me and my methods in there.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah. It's quite surprising to look in there and see, oh, seismic windows, and they have identified them for each month.
Uh-huh.
And, for example, in May, it was quite an ordinary month. Tide-wise, the moon and the perigee were some 4 days apart, and so the tides reached no higher than 7.3 feet at the Golden Gate, the difference between a high and a low on a single day.
Right.
But then in June, on June 2nd, we had an 8.3-foot range, and it gradually declined from that. And on that day, we had a 7.0 magnitude quake in the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. We hadn't had a major quake of 7 or better since April. All of May, we didn't get a 7.
Hmm.
And then we got that one on the 2nd, and on the 9th, a 7.7 in ADAC, and the 10th, 7.2 in ADAC, 11th, 7.2 in the Philippines, Samar Island, and on the 17th, a 7.5 or 8 by one reading, and the Flores Sea. Well, that meant 5 major quakes in 1 month.
Yeah, I've been watching these very closely.
And it averages only 1 per month. So we got 5 in the month of
okay,
June.
Well,
it's an extremely high tide month.
Right. Here's my question for you. I've been watching them. I get a fax report. Whenever an earthquake occurs.
Mm-hmm.
And there have been gigantic quakes, as you're pointing out, all around the Ring of Fire, very nearly, except the U.S. West Coast.
Yes, the last really prominent one was at May 2nd, 5.5 up at Seattle, and my newsletter recipients got their newsletter on the 1st or 2nd of May, and I had a dozen calls that night. Thank you. I kept my kids from going to the kingdom. Thank you. I did work on the. You were talking about working on maintenance of all of your equipment.
Yes.
And I went through my generator and refueled it and lubricated it. It was all ready when the power went off from the earthquake.
Huh.
I got lots of reports like that really gratify me.
What do you see coming? Would you care to make? Is there a prediction that you would make within the window that we're just about to move into?
Oh, sure.
Yeah,
but every window I have a prediction or one or more.
And what do you think?
Okay, there certainly ought to be at least one major quake around the Ring of Fire. In this window, there should be a 3.5 to 6 magnitude quake within 140 miles of Los Angeles.
Oh.
2 degrees. A similar magnitude quake within 70 miles of San Jose, and a similar magnitude quake within 70 miles or 1 degree of Seattle.
Wow.
Now, I've hit the only 2 Seattle quakes of 5 magnitude since 1965. The one last January 28th of 95 and May 2nd of 96. And both of those I predicted on their media just before the actual quake.
I've got the Seattle story here.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. How do your contemporaries look at you when you do this sort of thing publicly? Is there a lot of scorn still, or are they beginning to pay, you know, some homage to you?
It's gone beyond scorn to real resentment and anger in some cases. One of my erstwhile colleagues at the U.S. Geological Survey, I went to a session they had on April 18th
mm-hmm.
that was commemorating the April 18th, 1906 big one.
Yes.
And just as I came in the door, I heard that they had a quake. Well, it happened to be the second day of my April seismic window. And I was wanting to hear about some quakes. We hadn't had any for several weeks. And they said, we just had one. And it turned out to be a 3.7, although the first report was a 3.1, which was below my minimum of 3.5, and so I was a little disappointed. So we went into the meeting, and there they flashed up on the screen, 3.8, and I burst out. All right. And people suddenly looked at me and wondered. And so I said, well, yes, I predicted at least a 3.5, so that one made it. And then the beeper went off on the speaker's beeper.
Uh-huh.
And he said, oh, looks like we've had a little more seismic activity. We'll show you how this new rapid call-up feature works on our computer. So he plugged away, and all of a sudden his computer crashed because everybody was calling in at the same time. And after 20 minutes he was able to get through to his own station there, and it turned out to be a 4.7, the strongest in 3 years in the Bay Area. So that was quite pleasing to me because my range was a 3.5 to 5.5, and it was right in the middle. And so I saw this bearded geologist who is actually the one responsible for nearly having me fired when he gave some misinformation to the state geologist.
Mm-hmm.
So I saw him walking down the hall, and so I gave him a big smile, and I said, would you like a copy of my newsletter? I predicted the quake we just had. He looked stonily ahead and shoved this to one side, and he says, I don't want to deal with that, and he walked out the first door.
Oh, isn't science wonderful?
So, you know, it's vindication as far as I'm concerned.
Do you know a fellow named Charles Watson?
Oh, yes. I think he does a wonderful job.
He does. He's the fellow who sends me the faxes.
Yes.
And he is the equivalent of what I used to be. I used to chase tornadoes. I was one of those crazy people.
Uh-huh. I'm sure you've seen Twister.
As a matter of fact, I haven't seen it yet.
Oh,
no, I'll see it. And the reason I mentioned Charles Watson is because Charles Watson is, for earthquakes, what I suspect you are, the equivalent of a tornado chaser. And when he was on the air with me, I asked him, if you knew there was going to be a 5-point earthquake in a certain place, and you really knew where the exact epicenter was going to be, would you go and stand on the epicenter?
Oh, yes.
And his answer was a very quick yes. What would yours be?
No question.
No question.
I would like to know where the fault was, so I had at least, I wasn't straddling the fault. like to do the splits.
Right, but other than that, you'd stand relatively at the epicenter.
Oh, absolutely. People say, well, are you leaving the state, as I will be next week? Because of this window, and, you know, no, absolutely not. I would hate to miss something. I'm hoping it happens early on before I leave.
All right. Now, let me up the ante a little bit. Would you stand near the epicenter of a 7?
Well, I might be a little more judicious on that. I see no reason to be right on the epicenter. I'd like to be half a mile away.
Half a mile away.
Okay. I was 20 miles away from the epicenter of the 7.1 World Series quake, and that's the only quake that ever frightened me. But ironically, I was just heading out the door. I was on the 7th floor of the county building here in Santa Clara County in San Jose. And most of the staff had already left to dash home and watch the game.
Mm-hmm.
And at 5:03, I started out, and then I saw the phone, and I said, well, maybe I'll just check with the Berkeley Seismographic Station to see if my quake has happened yet.
Mm.
It could have been a 5 off the end of the county, and I might have missed it. So I dialed up the numbers, and I was within 1 or 2 digits of getting through when the quake struck.
Oh, brother.
And for about 2 seconds, I was exultant. I raised my fist in the air. I got my quake! And then I didn't want it because the tiles were undulating and I was crashing and all my rock collection and the books in the library were tumbling out and the whole floor was shaking and a giant microfilm reader slammed against me and I kept it from sliding on the floor and I was moving back and forth on the counter and my first comment was to anyone that was still left, we've got a major quake here. This is a 7. And my second thought was, my boss was at Candlestick Park, and I said, I hope it's closer to here than to Candlestick, because
yes.
If it had been centered by Candlestick, that would have really been devastation.
Well, as it was, it scared the
jabbers.
Yes, it certainly did, out of the people at Candlestick.
And I had tickets for the next day for my son and I, and we got to go, 10 days later after the delay?
Mm-hmm.
And most of the people sitting around us were there for that first occasion, so I got some very interesting videotape of comments.
How close are we, do you think, to what everybody calls the big one for California?
Well, for Northern California, I think we're 20 or 30 years away. The last major quake on the Loma Prieta area was 1865, mm-hmm. and it took 41 years before the big one. But in Southern California, they are far more overdue. Their last big one was 1857, so another 50 years further back in time, and that when that earthquake occurred, it was on the day of the full moon, January 9th, 1857,
mm-hmm.
and the ground moved 30 feet. That's why I say I'd like not to be straddling the fault line.
30 feet.
There was a round sheep corral that was 30 feet in diameter, and after the earthquake, it was the shape of the letter S.
Wow.
And it was slightly larger than the 1906 earthquake, probably an 8.4.
So what would you say when it does come in Southern California? Gordon Scallion has talked about a gigantic magnitude quake.
The unprecedented, and that goes beyond the geology.
Yes. But within the limits of what you know, what would you expect in Southern California?
Well, it's preferable to have an 8 on the San Andreas out by Palmdale or Palm Springs than a 7 in the Los Angeles Basin, just because everything is like a bowl of jelly, and there are so many additional fault lines that could be triggered into action. That's one thing that geologists used to sort of laugh at. They said, oh, earthquakes are all independent events except for the occasional foreshock and a lot of aftershocks, the big quakes. We recognize that, but a quake in Southern California has nothing to do with the big one in Northern California a week later.
Right. There is, however, the possibility of a domino kind of effect.
Well, yes. In fact, after the Landers earthquake in 1992, they changed their plans. In fact, it was delightful to me. They've just minutes after the Landers earthquake, there began to be a series of earthquakes in volcanic centers such as Mammoth Lake and Yellowstone and Lassen and Shasta, and there was absolutely no mistaking the pattern. They were triggered by the effect of this Landers earthquake hundreds of miles away. Of course, just 50 miles away was the Big Bear quake, 6.8.
How can that be?
Well, a fault line that is ready to fail doesn't need much to nudge it into action. If you have your palms pushed together with a shear couple set up between them, you know,
right.
Just it's ready to fail, and somebody comes and bumps your elbow, it's going to slip.
That's right.
It doesn't take much. If you had a dump truck with the sand in there filled up at the angle of repose, about 34 degrees, and it's all tilted up and it isn't sliding yet, and say a fellow on a motorcycle hits it from the side, it disturbs the equilibrium there,
and
it will cause that whole mass to start to slide out of the truck, even though it wasn't. The movement wasn't in the direction of the tilt of the sand, the maximum slope.
Well, I've heard a lot of talk lately about scientists wanting to put explosives in fault lines.
In fact, we first heard about that. I was going to Berkeley, and an engineering mining professor said, well, there's some talk about spot welding the San Andreas with H-bomb.
spot welding it with an H-bomb?
Well, I'm sure that was tongue-in-cheek, but it gave quite a picture. But then there were some very clear engineering solutions. I mean, these were written in our journals with complete candor.
Yes.
We think we can control the San Andreas by putting in steel-reinforced concrete beams across it, you know, bury them.
Girders.
Yeah, just like, stitches. Put stitches in the San Andreas. Well, of course, the Earth would just bypass those stitches quite easily.
Yes. Yes, the forces, were they really serious about that?
The stitches, yes, they were serious about that one.
Was there any reason to believe that anything like that could actually be done?
Well, from an engineering standpoint, I've always been asked, what's the difference between what an engineer does and what a geologist does? And I said, well, I brought it down to this, that a geologist goes out into the hills and listens to the rocks.
Uh-huh.
An engineer goes out into the hills and tells the rocks what to do.
All right. Well, when we come back after the top of the hour, we're going to be on the air, as you must know, there in the Bay Area.
Uh-huh.
And I don't want to scare anybody. In fact, we should issue the standard warning that what we're talking about here is a prediction.
Yes.
Even if it's one with a high probability.
Yes.
It is. And how probable, by the way, you said that was part of the prediction. How probable are the earthquakes that you're predicting to come in this window?
Well, this window, it gets the highest rating that I've ever gone, 85%. I did that
really?
With the Loma Prieta quake also.
Really? Yeah. 85%?
85%, because here we have the highest tides of the year. We have also the animals doing weird things. We're getting these people reports. My magnetic stress indicators have been showing strange behavior in the last few days after being stable for several weeks.
Really?
And I have checked on a few of the springs and haven't gotten positive data on that. One spring is very pertinent to the Calaveras fault.
All right. Hold it right there, Jim. We'll be right back to you. Jim Berkland, a retired California geologist, back in a moment.
The trip back in time continues with Art Bell hosting Coast to Coast AM. More Somewhere in Time coming up. Networks presents Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring Coast to Coast AM from June 28, 1996.
Good morning across this great land and well beyond, worldwide, I guess. This is Coast to Coast AM. My guest is retired California geologist Jim Berkland. And I want to issue the standard warnings right now. The Bay Area is coming online at this hour. They know Jim Berkland. You might not. But, oh, they know him. And you're going to hear some predictions of something that might be a little scary. If you are scared by this kind of thing, turn your radio off now. Please. Here we go again, and it never fails. It never, ever, ever fails. We're in now an earthquake window. As of about 10 minutes ago, we are in the biggest earthquake window of the year. Blue moon time, magnetic influences, the full moon coming up, tidal influences, and lots of other things. My guest is Jim Berkland, a retired California geologist, who has predicted many, many quakes and rates what he is predicting now in the 85 percentile range, and we'll repeat those predictions in just a moment. I just received a earthquake alert bulletin from our mutual friend Charles Watson, and it looks, another geologist, and it looks very much like there has just been, just now, a 5.9 preliminary magnitude earthquake near the coast of New Guinea. How about that, Jim?
Well, we get a 5, about 3 fives of day, actually, on average. For a quick rundown, if people just write down 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, and those are magnitudes,
mm-hmm.
and then alongside the 8 you put a 1, that's once a year, a 7, about 10 a year, actually about 14, but 10, and then 6, about 1,000 of them. I mean, 100 of them, so one every 3 days.
Okay.
And for a 5, you put down 1,000, so that's 3 a day. And for a 4, about 10,000. So see, these are really logarithmic. The energy involved of the earthquakes and the frequency, which is just the opposite. In fact, your single 8 magnitude quake may have more energy in it than all of the other quakes that we've had experienced.
Boy, that's
that year.
All right, well, the Bay Area is online now, so let's repeat the basic window information, what this special time is we're in right now, why we're in it, and what you predict to occur within it.
Okay, this is what I call a seismic window, and it's the clearest one of the year with the greatest probability of earthquakes in every seismic area, most seismic areas in the world. There are a few exceptional areas that have their own time periods. But for most of the world, the window is wide open now and will stay open through the 6th of July. And the reason it's open is that it's the day before the full moon, the second full moon in a single month, and so that will make it a blue moon.
Mm-hmm.
And the color doesn't really matter, but the fact that the moon is very close to us at this time makes that full moon, when it rises on the 30th, it'll look huge. And the tides...
In other words, it's going to be a lot closer. It's going to look huge because it is huge.
Yes, yes. It'll be quite a bit larger. In fact, that's the only time you can get a total solar eclipse is when the moon is close, because it looks bigger and it'll cover the whole face of the sun.
Right.
But if the moon is 2 weeks later at apogee, the far point, rather than the near point, perigee, then you will not get a total solar eclipse. You'll get an annular eclipse with just like a ring of fire all around this hole, like a donut, and because the moon is too far away to cover up the sun at that time, and it's not nearly as spectacular as the lunar eclipse, the solar full eclipses. I went to Peru to see the solar eclipse in Peru in 1994 on November 7th, like 11th, well, yeah, November
yes.
7th.
Mm-hmm.
And when the guide, the Peruvian guide, brought us to the Sacred Valley of the Incas, she said, "I am so glad you were able to see our eclipse. We in Peru have a tradition. We watch the eclipse, and then we wait for the earthquake." And she caught me by surprise. I said, "Would you repeat that again for my video camera, please?"
All right, look, let's get back to it because they want to hear it.
Yes.
So well, you've given us a window now through the 6th of July, a particularly dangerous time, and you predict to occur within this time the following.
A 3.5 to 6 magnitude earthquake. And people, you don't necessarily focus on the 6. You can focus at the lesser. Within 70 miles, 1 degree of San Jose. Within 140 miles of Los Angeles. Within 70 miles of Seattle. And somewhere around the Pacific Ring of Fire, expect a major quake, a 7 or better.
Oh, and that could be our part of the Ring of Fire, too.
Oh, sure. Oh, absolutely. Just like in 1989, I said the same thing. 85% confidence that we would have, originally I said a 3.5 to 6 magnitude quake within 1 degree of San Jose. And then as we approached that critical period of October 14th through 21st, 1989, the highest tidal force in 3 years, strange things begin to happen. We begin to have a tremendous number of missing pets. The lost and found column about quadrupled in length, much as it would after the 4th of July or after a very severe thunderstorm. Well, we didn't have the 4th of July in October or a thunderstorm here. And so when I saw the missing cats go from an average of 4 or 5 to 27 and the dogs go from an average of 20 to 58, I knew something was up.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we have that same situation developing now. The Los Angeles Times yesterday had 58 missing dogs,
wow,
which is one of the highest totals they've ever had. And here in San Jose, the Mercury News had a total of 37 missing dogs, which is the highest since Groundhog Day back in February.
Yikes.
And the missing cats are 16, and just 5 days ago they were at 9. So this 16 is the highest since just before the 4.8 quake we had that shook my home here back on the 21st of May. And we had my newsletter, it was at the printers on that very day, and in that June issue of Thysogy, my newsletter, there was a prediction that we would have a 5 or better in June, July, or August. Well, it happened to be a 4.8 on May 21st, but I don't feel too badly about that because I think we were going to get a little more.
All right. Well, this is with high confidence. You're saying that on the West Coast, even if we don't get the big one that's going to occur somewhere on the Ring of Fire, it's going to be boom, boom, boom.
Yes. I had a call from Tacoma that the Tacoma paper classified section had 38 missing pets, and just about 5 days ago it was down at 15. So something drove the animals out, and everyone's going to have a beautiful object lesson wherever you live in the country and wherever you celebrate the 4th of July, because you may not have any quakes around, but if you have the noise and excitement of the 4th of July, you'll find your dogs going bonkers, and they will go running blindly away, sometimes out into the traffic or up into the hills, and may run 20 or 30 miles, and you may never see them again, or you may find them at the pound, or you may find that some neighbor has come across them, and you, some small percentage of people that lose their pets will go spend the $30 or $40 required to get an ad in the newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you actually see the missing pets go from say, a total of 30 to 90 or 100,
that
you're looking at 90 or 100,000 animals.
Absolutely.
Perhaps.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely correct. Yes. All right. You've got to remember, we've got listeners coast to coast and way beyond. Alaskans all across Alaska were heard, even in the Midwest. So here's the facts. Dear Art, please ask Mr. Berkland, does he see any possibility of this particular quake window through the 8th of July affecting the central U.S., the new Madrid Fault and so forth?
Yes. There is a probably a 25% chance there because they don't have as many quakes as we get here.
It's just when they get them, it's not good.
Well, the big one in 1812 was on the day after the new moon, on December 16th of 1812. And that indicates the idea works there, too, because you don't need the ocean tides. The solid Earth moves up and down, too, under the gravitational stress of the sun and moon. Not the stars and planets. I don't use those at all because they have less than 1,000th the effect. Jupiter and Venus have about 1,000th the gravitational effect that the moon has.
So then what about these people that talk about when all the planets align? You
means
know,
that's nothing.
Means nothing. Uh-huh.
The Jupiter effect is ineffectual, and it was shown to be so back in, what, 84 or whenever that was supposed to be. But the big Alaskan quake,
yes.
The 8.4,
yes.
On Good Friday of 1964, was on the day of the full moon. And it occurred when the Cook Inlet was extremely low tide. The tide varied 35 feet, and it was at the time of day when it was extremely low, and that differential stress probably helped to trigger that quake. It would have happened anyway in a few days or weeks, but the actual extreme tides helped to pick that day.
Hmm.
And on that day at Seward, I had a call from a lady who said, "Stick with what you're doing. I was in Seward, and there were no seagulls flying over the waterfront. They all disappeared. And there were rats and mice running around in the streets in the daytime."
All right, and before people think you've totally lost your mind, there's good science behind this. In other words, animals, as do people, by the way, have a little area. Identify that for us again, if you would. Different animals and humans, I guess, of magnetic influence in their head.
Yes.
Right?
Magnetite is the black sand that's mainly in your gold pan when you're panning for gold.
Yes.
It weathers out of all kinds of rocks. And it's the most highly magnetic natural substance on Earth. It's just Fe3O4, three parts iron to four of oxygen.
Mm-hmm.
And the iron is in two different electrical states, the valence states. And it's the valence electron that jumps back and forth from orbit to orbit that makes this magnetic effect. And so animals make it for mainly navigational purposes. Even ancient Cambrian life, called chitons, primitive sea life, had magnetite in their teeth. And that, not only is it a very hard mineral, but it also might allow them to feed in parallel paths rather than bumping into each other and fighting over every scrap of algae that they're feeding on.
All right. Let me tell you what I've got here. First of all, I wasn't going to say anything about this, but I woke up with a horrible, horrible splitting headache.
Ooh.
Today.
Oh, boy.
And I've got already 20, 25 faxes here. Here's Ron from Birmingham, woke up with a horrible headache.
Oh, boy.
Here's Mark and Susie in LeGrand, Oregon, woke up with a strange feeling, nauseated, out of balance. Mm-hmm. I could go on and on and on.
Well,
I've got about, I don't know how many here, so we're sort of right in the middle of this.
Well, a very responsible assistant, gal, is associated with what I've been doing for some years. She gives me the daily lost and found column from the Los Angeles Times. She woke up this morning feeling very ill. She couldn't go to work on the regular schedule. They told her not to come in at all, but I think she went in the afternoon. And there are many, many people that report these things, and usually they're very reluctant to discuss it in the open. You know, it's just a family thing, and they're the butt of jokes.
Yes, but, I know.
But they know that I've been through those things, and so they confide in me. And then when they find out they're not alone in the world, that there are a lot of people with these same symptoms, then that's very reassuring to them. Now, the first time I ever heard about it, and each of these things I get into is rather reluctantly, you know, I'm a scientist, and so I have this skepticism sort of built in, but then I want to see what happens, and so I'm willing to test things. And so this lady called me from New Brunswick, Canada, where she said, she was a native New Brunswicker. Actually, the first contact was by letter.
Mm-hmm.
About a week after, they had a 5.9 quake on the day of the eclipse of the moon on January 9th, 1982. And since my wife is from eastern Canada, I sort of an affinity there. And she heard me on a local station because Stan Friedman, whom you know well, had a science radio show back there. He just moved into Fredericton, and he knew that their quake fit my theory. And so they called me from the radio station, did I predict their quake? Well, I said, no, I predicted the window, but I didn't know what was happening locally there to actually pin down your area as likely. Well, what do you mean? I said, well, like the water well changes and the radon gas and the tilt of the ground and any creeping faults and and animal activity. And she said, that sounds interesting. Do you mind if I roll a tape? And I said, no, go right ahead. She said, just a moment. Oh, my God, not another one. And she had a 5.5 magnitude quake while she was on the phone with me. Now, what are the chances you have a transcontinental call and a 5.5 hits and the epicenter's on the east end of that call? That's pretty unusual.
Very unlikely, yes.
So it went on the Going Home show that night. And so 10 days later, I got this letter out of the blue. Mr. Berkland said, Sonia Cuddyback, and I've lost her totally. I hope she contacts me again sometime. She said, I'm a native New Brunswicker. I'm a school teacher. And I heard you talking about what animals get. I hope you can explain what happened to me. Otherwise, I feel I'm losing my mind. I've never had any kind of sinus problems. And I've also never felt an earthquake before. But 4 days before that jolt, my head began to stuff up, and I got a tremendous headache that aspirin couldn't touch. Mm-hmm. I was hyperactive. I couldn't even stay seated at luncheon with some teacher friends 2 days before the quake. The day before the quake, I felt compelled to clean my house from top to bottom, and I'm normally quite content to leave books on the dust balls and the dishes in the sink and go to my studio and paint. But she was driven like maybe a pregnant woman was before giving birth. Has to make the nest right for something that's coming. The next day, she went to bed without supper that night. Next morning, tried to get up early, couldn't. She said, I lay back on the bed, and suddenly, as if passing over a mountain peak, why, the pressure disappeared and the pain disappeared. And as I marveled at this first return to normalcy, the first tremors hit. Now, that was on a Saturday. The next day, she felt pretty good, and then towards the evening, it began to stuff up again, and a headache came, and the next day was this 5.5 aftershock that hit when I was on the phone.
Why do you think that the pressure is relieved before the quake is felt?
Well, that is kind of an interesting point. I know sometimes you get the symptoms without the actual rupture.
Right.
But why you would suddenly have a pause just before the actual event? It's like, well, the animals are often quite noisy until just before the quake. Birds and insects and everything quiet down. It's an eerie stillness just before a significant quake. I've heard this report from many, many people.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like you're just gathering yourself for the effort.
I doubt this relates, but I am told that people who are dying just before actual death have a moment of total clarity, total lucidity. Have you heard that?
Yes, they often make their last statement. And about what they're seeing or something, or saying goodbye to their family.
Yes.
Yes, that's interesting. That's an interesting analogy.
I don't know if it relates at all, but
well,
I just happened to think of that when you were describing that. Well, what we're going to do, I hope, is to be taking calls here shortly.
Please.
And what people will do when we take calls is they will ask you about their area, inevitably, selfishly, wanting to know, and I don't blame them a bit, so I'm going to get the jump on them. I happen to live out here in southern Nevada. I live about 65 miles west of Las Vegas, about 8 miles from the California border, not far from what's called Area 51, and I think I live in a pretty cool earthquake-proof place, but I don't, do I?
That's why Yucca Mountain was selected as a site for the nuclear waste depository site.
But it's also
never to expect any quake of greater than 5 magnitude, and then after the Landers quake, about 4 days after, they had a 5.6.
So, where I am, what could I expect? Am I in a relatively safe place, or?
Well, if you get close to bedrock, that's usually a better situation. Certainly, in 1954, you had a couple of middle 7 magnitude earthquakes there.
Oh.
Not too far from Fallon. I mean, that's well north to the north of you, but
north,
you certainly felt them down your way.
Mm-hmm.
Nevada is one of the shakier states. It's right up there with Washington.
Great.
We have to put Alaska first and California second and Hawaii third. And then
really? Hawaii third? Really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because of all the volcanic activity. They've had some 8 magnitude quakes.
In Hawaii?
Oh, yes.
When?
Oh, yes. Well, see, I think it was 1862.
Holy mackerel.
It killed a couple hundred people there.
An 8 magnitude quake in the islands?
On the Big Island. That's about the only place that's still shaking really strongly.
Well, I know, but wouldn't something like that potentially produce a tsunami?
Oh, it could. A tsunami requires up and down motion on the seafloor. So the San Andreas Fault isn't going to give you much of a tsunami.
Mm-hmm.
It's like if you have a big dish pan full of water and there's a big platter in the bottom. If you pick the platter up by the edge and just slip it out, nothing happens.
All right, we're going to
pick it up straight. It's going to make up the water well over the top.
I've got you. All right, stay put. We'll be right back to you and your calls. Jim Berkland back in a moment.
This is Premier Networks. That was Art Bell hosting Coast to Coast AM on this Somewhere in Time. Take you back to the past on Art Bell Somewhere in Time.
Can you feel it? The hairs on the back of your neck? A little bit more hyper than usual, sort of tense. Maybe a headache. Well, we're in a window. A big one. My guest is retired California geologist Jim Berkland. And we'll tell you a little more about Jim Berkland in a moment. To Jim Berkland, who is in fact a retired California geologist, actually was employed by a county in California, and he'll tell you all about it in a moment because I'm going to read him a fax, many nice faxes, but I will choose this one just to bring Jim out. Art, Jim Berkland is a blowhard, signed a real geologist, no name, but signed a real geologist. You are a real geologist, aren't you, Jim?
Oh, yes. I felt a little pee under my mattress last night.
Why don't you tell people what a few of the societies that you belong to, where you were educated, that sort of thing?
Yes, I got my bachelor's in geology at the University of California, Berkeley.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked 6 years with the U.S. Geological Survey. Then I went back to school to get my master's in geology at San Jose State University. And then I worked for 5 years with the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation as an engineering geologist.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went back to school to work on my doctorate at UC Davis. I worked 3 years and did everything but pass my orals and did everything but complete my dissertation. I had a 250-page dissertation, which I brought with me to my teaching back at Appalachian State University, and so many other activities and exciting things developed that I never completed that part of my work. And then I accepted the role as the first county geologist in Santa Clara County. And I did teach one class in engineering geology to San Jose State University. I published more than 50 scientific papers. But interestingly, when I tried to publish on earthquakes and seismic windows, I find the critics refusing to accept them for publication.
Yes. Well, I have a feeling the facts are here, unsigned, other than a real geologist, is one of your critics.
Well, I'm a fellow in the Geological Society of America. I've been a member since 1959. And I am a member of the Seismological Society of America, the Earthquake Engineering Research Institute, the Peninsula Geological Society, the American Association for the Advancement of Science. And I founded the SABRE Society, which was an interprofessional group that operated for about 18 years here, based at San Jose State University.
Mm-hmm.
I take my science very seriously, and I find that if you close your mind, you're no longer a scientist.
All right. I've got a lot of calls here. A lot of people want to talk to you, so let us go to the lines. First time caller line, you are on the air with Jim Berkland. Hi. Where are you, please?
Hi, I'm Casey from Modesto, California.
Modesto. All right.
Yeah, I've noticed something strange. I was sitting outside just a few minutes ago, and I heard a lot of birds singing.
Uh-huh.
And also, I'm just wondering, is that any sign or anything?
At this time of night?
It's fairly unusual. If you haven't heard it before, then you would say it's abnormal. That's it. What may be normal for a pet? You know, they said my pet is crazy all the time. My cat is crazy all the time. I said, well, if it starts acting normal, then look out. You know, it's acting differently.
So in other words, whatever is abnormal.
Yes. Yes.
All right. Very good. Wild card line. You're on the air with Jim Berkland. Good morning.
Good morning. This is Dave from Avila Beach, California.
Hi, Dave.
You've had some really interesting guests on lately, Art.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it. I grew up near the San Andreas Fault, north end, San Bernardino. And then at age 13, I moved to Alaska and commercial fishing Prince William Sound and seen a lot of the destruction, the aftermath from the 64 earthquake.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a question. I'm still in the fishing industry. I live here in Avila Beach, fairly close to Parkfield. And I was wondering, is there any changes in regards to, like, sea mammals or fish before an earthquake?
Mm. Absolutely. Absolutely. For example, in the 3 weeks prior to our Loma Prieta quake, at Ocean Beach in San Francisco, there were two beaked whales, baby beaked whales, that washed ashore. And these things were about 9 feet long. They were alive, and they'd never seen live ones before. Extremely rare. They brought them over to Marine World, and they tried to give them ground-up fish food, and they were trying to nurse from the fingers of the keepers. And so they realized these were younger than they thought, and they brought in milk. And they survived for, just a couple of weeks. But they died, I believe, before the earthquake itself. While these rare beasts were being taken care of at Marine World, another rare pygmy sperm whale washed up to Santa Cruz Beach. And that they brought down to the Monterey Aquarium, where they were taking care of that. That did last past the time of the earthquake. But just the existence and washing up of these critters alive would have been newsworthy even if the quake hadn't followed. So the strongest quake since 1906 in the Bay Area is accompanied by this extremely rare marine mammal beaching. The worst case of marine mammal beaching in the history of California was in late January of 1971. And you know what happened on February 9th of 1971, on the day of the eclipse of the moon, we got the San Fernando earthquake. And there were 200 dolphins that had beached on San Clemente Island in late January.
Wow.
He's right.
I live close to a nuclear power plant, too. I'm kind of concerned about that.
Mm.
Oh, that's an awfully good question. Jim, what can you tell us about the nuclear plants? And, in other words, have they been built well enough that if an eight-pointer touches off somewhere in Southern California, the plant's going to stay in one piece? Or what do you know about that?
Well, I could say I hope so. You remember when they completed that plant and they assured us that it had been designed for like a 7-magnitude quake?
Yes.
And then they discovered another fault offshore that was capable of an 8?
I know. They're always discovering new faults.
Yes. And then they also discovered that the plumbing had been installed on a mirror image rather than the way it was supposed to be. They had to go back and revise everything. It was completed. And they had to go back in and tear it up and rebuild it the way the plans were supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good idea to be skeptical no matter what the source of information. I usually hope that people are skeptical about what I'm saying. But then wait and see what happens.
But again, for what you are predicting, the boom, boom, boom along the West Coast, that is, you're predicting that with about an 85% probability of occurring.
Yes.
And that's within the next, through July 6th.
8 days, yes. For example, the highest tidal force in the history of the world since 1600 to the year 2200. It's in a book by Dr. Fergus Wood, formerly with the they used to call it U.S. Coast and Geodetic Survey, and then became the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Anyway, is a genius and a master meteorologist, oceanographer, and geophysicist. Anyway, this book shows all of my seismic windows, and I didn't run across it until about 1979 after I've been doing it for 5 years. So in that book, he described the strongest tidal force that in this 600-year period has occurred on January 4th, 1912. So as soon as I saw that date, guess what's the first thing I did?
Mm-hmm.
Went to the earthquake records. And in the U.S. earthquake book, published every few years by the Department of Interior, they had listed for 1912, 1913, only two quakes for California and Nevada. One was in December of 1912, down near Oxnard, about a 5.
Right.
But the stronger quake, the strongest in 2 years in two states, was near Bishop, about a 5.5. It was felt strongly in Fresno and Bakersfield, and that was on January 4th, 1912, the day of the maximum tidal force in 600 years. And so I brought this information to my friends at the USGS, and they said, Jim, haven't you heard of coincidence? And I said, yes, I've also heard of corroborative evidence.
And yes, I mean, after all, Jim, you've been doing this so long now, so long now that it is science. I mean, how can they deny that it's science?
Well, when they say I'm lucky, then I say, well, isn't lucky rather a mystical concept?
Mystical indeed. In other words, science is nothing if it is not repeatability. And if you can demonstrate that, then I don't see how they... Well, I guess I do see how.
They have a different agenda. And so often they will say, we can't lend any credibility to this work because other people have looked at it and they failed to find any correlation between tides and quakes. Well, they are unfamiliar with the 300 articles in the world literature over the last 30 years or so. In fact, two scientists in 1983 in the journal Nature noted that the pattern of larger earthquakes in Southern California seemed to be that there would be stronger quakes, 6 magnitude or better, around the time of the nodal point of the moon every 19.6 years. Now, the nodal point is when it's as high in the sky as it can get, so it's exerting the greatest gravity at this latitude.
Yes.
And in 1983, in July, in that issue, they projected ahead to November of 87, 4 years later, when would be the next nodal point. And they said, we expect there will be a 6 on the San Andreas system in Southern California around November of 87. Hmm. Well, on October 1st of 87, not quite November, the strongest quake since 1982 hit, and that was at Whittier. First given a 6.1 and later lowered to about a 5.9. So they'd say, well, it didn't make a 6. Besides, it wasn't on the San Andreas proper. Well, then on November 23rd of 1987, I was working in my office on the 7th floor of the Santa Clara County building.
Right.
I noticed that my pendulum, I have just a carpenter's plumb bob on about a 5-foot catgut.
Right.
Sending from the ceiling. It was swaying about 2 inches. And everybody was leaving around dusk. And I said, look at that. It was doing that same thing back in 1979 when they had the 6.5 magnitude quake down at in Brawley. And sure enough, it was the Superstition Hill's fault. It cut loose with a 6.3 near dusk, just as predicted by Drs. Konopoff and Steve Kilston, the astronomer, in their article. And the next morning, near dawn, as predicted by them, a 6.8 followed. So they got 2 quakes in November of 87, predicted 4 years in advance, and Steve Kilston, the astronomer, was elated, and I've heard him speak. I sat in the audience and heard him talking about syzygies and perigees and perihelions and saying, the U.S. Geological Survey won't return my calls.
Well.
So, and then Dr. Konopoff had an interesting reaction. He's an emeritus professor of seismology at UCLA, a world reputation to uphold. And after the quake, he was quoted as saying, I've just spent the last 4 years trying to convince my colleagues I hadn't actually predicted a quake, and the damn thing happened.
All right, here you go. Here's another one. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Jim Berkland. Where are you, please?
Traverse City, Michigan.
Welcome to the show.
I remember a Sunday morning episode with Charles Osgood about a lady who was documenting hot springs.
Yeah.
Geysers?
Yes, yes. Olga Kolbeck up here in Calistoga. I know her very well.
And another gentleman that was that had sort of...
radio signals.
A headache or something.
Uh-huh.
And a few days before.
Yes.
Or a week before, a quake would recur.
Uh-huh. Well, that's...
And also, I wanted to ask Art if he was on Okinawa, I'm just trying to remember, 75... 74.
Yeah, I went through some whiz bangers there, sir. Yeah, you bet. I was working, Jim, at a radio station, KSBK, in Naha, Okinawa, and you know where Okinawa is. And we had a microphone, you know, one of those old RCA ribbon microphones. It's a big mic. And it was hung from the ceiling by a tripod. In other words, three wires that came down from the ceiling.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
held the mic right in front of us. And, I'll tell you, you get some big earthquakes over there.
Loosen teeth.
And I was, that's right, I was on the air. And I watched this microphone take off toward the wall, which was about 4 or 5 feet away, and head back toward me. And I screamed and ducked, and it would have knocked my teeth out.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just got down on the floor and rode that one out. So I've been through some pretty big ones.
Well, when a 6.2 Morgan Hill quake hit, my plumb bob began to... sort of box the compass. It swung further and further towards the window, and it actually began to touch the window, and so I shouldn't have gotten next to the plate glass, but I did, and I cushioned it and brought it back to a resting point, and it continued to then build up the swing again, but never got as far as the window. But like my colleague said, well, I'm sure glad you took it so easy, because I'd have been scared if we hadn't been next to you.
All right. Here we go again. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Jim Berkland. Hi.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
I am a geologist, been in the oil business, and have worked California primarily for the last 20 years.
Where are you now, by the way?
I'm living in Golden, Colorado, listening to KHOW.
Okay.
You do make my day job kind of tough to get to, Art.
Sorry about that.
That's okay. Anyway, I have three questions, but a comment first. Just a little additional piece of corroborative evidence to support your tidal theory. Throughout California, I have done some geophysical measurements with gravity meters.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just to corroborate your theory on it, the effect that the tidal forces have, we do have to correct for the tidal forces in our gravity meters,
mm-hmm.
because gravity is not a constant.
Mm-hmm.
That's just one little piece of evidence that, you know, adds to your theory. My main questions are this. You know, the San Andreas tectonics have occurred really for the last 29, 30 million years based on the evidence.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Oligocene. Throughout the world, of course, it's a multi-billion-year-old cycle. Do you have any theories, that vary much from the general thinking in the geologic community towards plate tectonics and, you know, how they affect the movement, how the mantle movement affects the movement of the plates. And then the second question that I have is, and I'll listen off the air, are you familiar with Lawrence Livermore's attempts to drill about a 50,000-foot well in the Carrizo Valley within a half a mile of the San Andreas Fault, stopping every 1,000 meters or so to drill a horizontal lateral 3,000 to 4,000 feet through the fault zone, continuously coring?
No, I just was aware of what they're doing up in the Tehachapis. And it was interesting that when they drilled down about over 5,000 feet, they got water samples, expecting it might be juvenile water coming up from below.
Mm-hmm.
And from the isotopic analysis, it turned out to be meteoric water. It was rainwater that had filtered its way down, which helps to explain why landslides will develop often after the heaviest rainfall, maybe a month or so, as the water percolates down to the slide plain. The same thing with earthquakes. And that's why I was telling people up in the Northwest, they had their record, their, you know, 100-year floods here last winter.
That's right.
And I said, oh, boy, these high tide periods coming up towards summer look to be extremely important. And sure enough, the biggest quake in 31 years did hit on the 2nd of May. Same way in Landers in 1992, there were tremendous floods in Southern California, and twice the Los Angeles River lived up to its name, was a raging torrent. You may remember the poignant scene of this young boy, Hispanic kid, was swept down in the current, and the fireman reached over from a overpass and tried to grab his hand, and he slipped free, and he drowned.
Yep.
Well, it was just 2 months later when the Landers quake hit on June 28th, just 2 days before the eclipse of the sun.
All right, we don't have a lot of time for the top of the hour, but he wanted to ask you about mantle movement and tectonic theory.
Well, I'm not a geophysicist nor a seismologist, and I'm willing to accept that the plates are driven by plumes, heat plumes coming up from deep down in the lower mantle, and they come up like in a heated pot of soup. They form currents that come up, and they drive the surface material apart, and that's constantly replaced up in the center, and it goes back down at the edges. And that is analogous to what happens in, you know, the Kilauea fire pit. They've got a lot of photographs of the kind of mechanism that's been proposed for the plates. We know when new material comes up, it must go someplace, otherwise the Earth would be expanding constantly,
mm-hmm.
and then they... It fit in nicely. That's where the trenches are, and that's where the oceanic plates are driven down beneath the continental plates in most cases, and create the deeper and deeper earthquakes as you go away from the oceans and deep under the continents.
Mm-hmm.
But I, at the international meeting of the Geological Society in Montreal in 1972, I raised a question that's never been answered by anybody. We're given the plate tectonics theory as a given mechanism. It's already in operation, but it has to start somewhere. Did it start with the trenches, or did it start with the ridges? The new material coming up, or the old material sort of going down and dragging the plates with them.
Right.
Well, I think it actually began with the heat, the convection driving up and creating the ridges. Well, then the Earth's lithosphere, the upper mantle and the crust, can accept an awful lot of compression. And through a few million years, even 1,000 feet of plate can accept this compression. And then it has to go somewhere. And so then a trench must be initiated if this is the right order.
Right.
And when it's initiated, it must be an horrendous event. You know, just suddenly whoosh, and you might create a very large earthquake at such a point.
Hmm.
And,
all right, there's a couple things. We're breaking here at the top of the hour. We've got news, but it begs a million questions. Do you know of a fellow named Stan Deo down in Australia?
Oh, yeah.
You know of Stan. All right,
yeah.
We're
going to
talk about Stan. You mentioned heat plumes, and Stan Deo's name came to mind immediately. So
yeah.
Rest. We'll be back to you in a few moments, Jim.
Very good.
California retired geologist Jim Berkland is my guest.
The trip back in time continues with Art Bell hosting Coast to Coast AM. More Somewhere in Time coming up. Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring Coast to Coast AM from the 28th of June, 1996.
My guest is retired geologist, California geologist, Jim Berkland. The people on the West Coast know Jim Berkland very, very well because of years and years of accurate predictions of earthquakes. We are now about a little better than an hour into a big window. Next few days, next week or so. It's a big window, folks. Jim Berkland says there are going to be 3 earthquakes here on the West Coast. L.A. area, San Francisco area, and up in Washington. He'll tell you all about them in a moment. For those just joining at this hour, we'll try and repeat some of the info. We'll get back to it and Jim in just a moment. To Jim Berkland, I want to remind everybody, there is a photograph of my wild cat, my wild comet, on my webpage now. You can see it. Everybody's asking me to put up a photograph of Comet. So there he is on the webpage. And this morning's guest, Jim Berkland, while he doesn't have a webpage, we found a number of references to Jim Berkland and earthquakes. And so we put links in from my webpage, of course, with Keith Rowland right on top of it. Boom, boom, boom. We've got those links in. So if you want to know more about Jim Berkland, you should visit my webpage. That is www.artbell.com. www.artbell.com. Back now we go to Jim Berkland. Jim.
Yes, sir. You mentioned the books on tape, and it made me... reminded me that I'm a life member of our Lions Blind Center, and every month I record my Syzygy newsletter for the Blind Center.
Excellent.
And that, you know, another little thing that makes me feel good is that people are paying attention to what I'm saying.
Well, look, I haven't even let you plug it, so let's plug your newsletter. How do people get? Is it a monthly?
Yes.
All right.
Yes.
How do they get it?
Send me a self-addressed stamped envelope. I must say, after the 5.1 quake hit Seattle last year in January, just after I predicted on their television and radio,
yes,
I got over 2,000 letters. And so I must beg people to send a self-addressed stamped envelope, and I'll be happy to send them a back issue.
Now, you be careful. And I'm going to tell you why to be careful. I just had Daniel Brinkley on.
Uh-huh.
He offered to sign some books that he was selling.
Uh-huh.
He got 5,000 books. 5,000
Well,
books.
I can handle 5,000.
You can handle 5,000.
Yes. I have a lot of newsletters left over.
Well, you better have.
Every month.
You better have.
And you really send them a copy, huh?
I sure
free,
will.
Free of charge. Boy, are you going to be doing a lot of stuff in the envelope.
Well, there's nothing like your show. I've really been wanting to be on your show for a couple of years.
Well, people have been bugging me for a couple of years, and I don't know why it took me this long to get it done. But I had several calls about you the other day, and so it just all came together.
Well, perfect timing with this window, the transparent window that just opened at midnight.
All right, we will, yeah, that's about an hour and 15 minutes ago, West Coast time. We'll tell everybody about that again because we had a lot of stations just join us top of this hour. We're in a big window. It's a big, strange time we're in right now. We'll tell you about it in a moment. Phone calls waiting. Let's get to these first. First time caller line, you're on the air with Jim Berkland. Hi.
Hi there, Art.
Where are you?
I'm in Colorado, the lovely state of Colorado.
All right.
And I've got a couple of questions for you guys here. One, I spent several years working at a major insurance company doing homeowners insurance.
Yes.
We worked with the state of Utah, and, you know, there's a fault that runs through Utah
Wasatch.
And up into Colorado.
Wasatch Fault is really probably the most hazardous fault in the United States.
Really, that's what I was going to ask you, because I know during our training and during certain times of the year, we were always taught that the longer a fault stays, it builds up tension.
The longer the wait, the bigger the quake.
Yeah. Yeah, and I was just wondering, what would be the conditions to have that hit right? I know we felt some, like in southern Colorado, when they've had minor ones along the Wasatch Fault further
down
into Utah.
Well, I thought you were especially ripe back in 1982, 83, when the Salt Lake was filling rapidly and spilling out into the Great Salt Desert, the Bonneville Salt Lake, because you were unloading the mountains. The snow was melting and coming down and filling the valley, loading the valley. Mm-hmm. And the mountains are moving up and the valley is dropping down as along the Wasatch Fault.
Mm-hmm.
And this was abetting that. This was helping it. Now, it hasn't had a major earthquake on that fault since probably 1600-something.
Mm-hmm.
And that was at the end of what's called the Little Ice Age, when there was a lot more precipitation. And I'm sure Lake Bonneville was at a higher stand at that time, too. So it may have had an effect then, but it didn't seem to have much of an effect this time. There was about a 5-magnitude quake out by the airport there in 1982 in, I think, September. And that may be all that the maximum stresses, whatever you impose on a fault line, if the fault line's not ready to fail, and it can only yield the energy that's stored up on it. So if you've just had a big earthquake on a fault and you happen to have the greatest tides in 1,000 years, you're not going to get a great earthquake.
Mm-hmm.
It's already been relieved. So I'm not concerned, for example, about the southern San Andreas Fault in the south peninsula of this area.
Yeah, because it releases pretty regularly.
Yeah. It cleared its throat.
Uh-huh. Okay. And one last question.
Sure.
My mother works at the Mental Health Institute here in town, and she's always saying it gets pretty particularly
weird.
Scary right around the full moon.
Yes, you talk to sheriffs and medical people, maternity wards.
Talk show hosts.
Yeah.
Hey, believe me, Jim. I've been doing this for 12 years now, this program, in the all-night portion particularly, and I'm telling you, that at a full moon, things get really, really, really weird.
I'll try to get hold of that book by Dr. Arnold Lieber. It came out about 15 years ago. It's called The Lunar Effect.
Yes.
A very small, not a very large book, but full of information. And he ran into the same problems I have. He was saying, as Dade County, Florida psychologist, he had access to all of their suicides, for example.
Yes.
And he found a tremendous correlation with the phase of the moon, especially full moon.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as he published on it, he was attacked rather viciously by his colleagues. And it turns out they weren't even arguing about what he was doing. They were arguing about what they were doing. they were arguing about the time of death of the victim rather than the time of the attack.
Yes.
The death is sort of random, sometimes drags out for months.
Sure.
But the attack time is what was critical, and they were analyzing the wrong end of the situation.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a chapter in there about the Earth and the geophysical environment. Some articles about the quakes. Here's something that relates directly to the moon. When the astronauts landed on the moon, about the first three times, they put seismographs there.
Mm-hmm.
And we established without any question there are lunar quakes. There are moon quakes. And they occur almost all at the time of the monthly perigee when the Earth's gravity is strongest because you're closest to the moon.
Huh.
And when I went, when I first heard about that, about 1976, and I'd only been at my studies for 2 years at that point, I thought, here's great corroboration. Again, I hear, well, come on, the Earth is 81 times as massive as the moon. So it's easy to see how the Earth's gravity could trigger moonquakes, but you couldn't turn that around. And I said, come on, now the moon doesn't have a liquid core, it doesn't have moving plates, it doesn't have active volcanoes that we know about, and the Earth has all of those. So if you had the Earth is like a growing baby, and the moon is like an old man. If you had this baby and an old man lying on a cot side by side,
mm-hmm.
and you stroked each of their soles of their feet with a feather, where would you going to get the reaction?
Yeah. Yes, exactly. All right, wild card line, you're on the air with Jim Berkland. Hello.
Hi, it's Diana in Los Angeles.
Hi.
Aren't you do wonderfully incisive programs about subjects that, you know, are hard to find, except maybe for the Learning Channel on TV. And I've heard Jim before. And actually, tonight I want to bring up something that might be startling. Actually, after the time of the earthquake, friends who were subscribers
Northridge?
To JPL...
Northridge quake?
Yeah, exactly. Uh-huh. Yeah, 94. Friends who were subscribers to JPL got a printout, and the printout showed that actually we don't have to worry about the San Andreas fault. We've already been through the big one.
Uh-huh.
The moment-to-moment 250 zip code aspects on the JPL printout showed that San Fernando actually lacked the honor. They had a 9.6 moment magnitude, and Northridge had 9.5, 9.4, 9.3. Sherman Oaks, Van Nuys had 8.3 to 8.4. Up in the hills of Sherman Oaks and Encino was 8.3. On the other side of the hill with, say, Lax, Santa Monica was like 5.5 to 6. Century City, Beverly Hills was 6.6. Hollywood was 6.6.
Okay. All right. We get the idea. Allow him to respond to this.
Yeah. What you're giving me are the intensity numbers, usually given in Roman numerals. And they vary from place to place, but each earthquake has only one magnitude, one energy. How many sticks of dynamite was it equivalent to? But the effects are which side of the brick wall were you on? How far away were you from the explosion? So there is an infinite number of intensities. And it varies usually upon your local geologic setting and the type of structure you're in. But all those numbers you gave me were not, you know, we have never, the world has never experienced a 9 Richter magnitude, as far as we know. The Lisbon quake of 1755 is about 8.9.
We have 250 zip codes. That's the way it's done now.
Yeah.
So if you don't want to have the federal government pay over an 8.0 for people's damage, regardless of how wealthy they are, and excerpt them from paying taxes in the year that an 8.0 happened, then you're going to pick the lowest magnitude. And fortunately,
City Hall
was 6.6.
All right, we get it. Well, that sounds like a conspiracy theory regarding...
Insurance companies.
Yeah, it really does, doesn't it? But there have not been... What would happen, Jim, if an 8.0... I mean, she was wielding numbers around there.
Yeah.
If an 8-point earthquake occurred in the Los Angeles basin area somewhere there, what would it do?
Well, it depends on the type of fault. And if it's a thrust fault, like the Northridge quake, it's usually worse on the upper plate, where massive rocks are moving up and over the lower plate on a gently sloping surface. And if it's a strike-slip fault, it's usually a neater earthquake, a cleaner bundle of energy. And as I mentioned, you don't get tsunamis from the sideways motions.
Right.
But it's very difficult to anticipate. Like the epicenter of Loma Prieta was 60 miles away from
San Francisco. Let me try it this way. You remember the earthquake, the big one in Alaska?
Sure.
If that earthquake occurred in Los Angeles, what would be the results?
Well, probably 10,000 deaths.
10,000 dead?
Mm-hmm.
The buildings?
Oh, in fact, even the nice steel concrete buildings that we put so much faith in failed in many places from Northridge. It's caused a reevaluation of our whole safety program down there.
As a matter of fact, the Japanese were very pompous about their building techniques.
In Kobe.
Indeed, they claimed that, why, we've built earthquake-proof buildings, and they went down like 10 pins.
It can't happen here. We've heard that before, yeah.
And it did.
Yes. Yeah. Again, skepticism is the word of the day. Every earthquake is unique, and every earthquake is a learning experience. And our safety measures are about 10 years behind Mother Nature. We came up with the Field Act, which in California is probably the single greatest safety act on seismic matters that ever occurred. Mm-hmm. And it followed the Long Beach earthquake of 1933, which occurred on March 10th on the day of the eclipse of the moon. And in researching that, a few years ago, in some old newspapers, I saw some startling information.
Mm-hmm.
The governor was so, and Southern California was so shaken to their core by this 6.3 quake in which dozens of schools collapsed, the old unreinforced masonry schools that were so typical. They did a quick study. They hired a commission. Within 3 weeks, the commission reported to Governor, I think, Olson at the time, and they said, had that earthquake not occurred at 5:45 in the afternoon, but around 2 o'clock in the afternoon when all of the schools were in full session, we would have lost between 10,000 and 30,000 kids.
Oh my God.
Now, that's the reason the legislature got off its duff and adopted the Field Act that same month. And the Field Act said, something special about schools. We've got kids in here, and that's our future, and so we're going to design these to a much higher standard. And through the years, since 1933, the post-Field Act schools have done very well, and the pre-Field Act schools have almost been wiped out by subsequent earthquakes. But a real caveat there, the Field Act only applies to public schools. So those parochial and private schools, to whom the buildings have been sold at bargain prices, they still have the same risk.
Boy. First-time caller line, you're on the air with Jim Berkland. Hi.
Hi, this is Linda in Carson City, Nevada.
Hello, Linda.
Hi. I just have a few comments to make about the behavior of animals before and after earthquakes.
Uh-huh.
Presently, I have a small dog. I've only had her for about a year and a half. But I also have an Amazon parrot that I've had for about 16 years.
Yes.
I lived in the San Francisco Bay Area for quite some time. And even when I could not feel an earthquake, the parrot could.
Mm-hmm.
Because you would be awakened in the middle of the night to flap, 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 bang. Because the parrot would fall off his perch.
And they'll hang upside down for long periods.
Oh, he will go onto the side of his cage and not come off.
And if you had an open door, they would fly out and might go clear out of the home and not come back.
Yeah. Well, and lately, the dog will not let me out of its sight.
Oh, wow.
The parrot has been hanging on the side of the cage.
Well, you're giving me those symptoms that I...
And two deer were down in my backyard at noon less than a week ago.
Yeah, see, my fax machine right now is going absolutely crackers with the exact kind of thing this lady just said.
Uh-huh.
Exactly. So.
Well, see, this is what I've been hoping to get, a clearinghouse for this kind of exotic information. And it could be based on the seismic windows known for your particular area. As I say, most of the windows are for the United States are the same window we have that I've been talking about. But if you lived in the Salton Sea, you would find it didn't fit. I had one woman that around here that was just panicked about earthquakes. And I said, well, you could get another place down by Brawley, and you could move down there during the windows here and move up back up here during the windows down there.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, there was a fellow in the movie industry that goes to Sedona, where it's very quiet, seismically too, and comes back to his Hollywood work between the windows. And one night he came back in to the Los Angeles airport, had been here just for about 2 hours when a 5-magnitude quake hit, and I got a rather angry call from him that night. You didn't tell me about this one. Well, I don't get them all.
Right. All right. East of the Rockies, real quickly. You're on the air. Where are you calling from, please?
Upstate New York.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, Jim, listen, I live right on Lake Ontario, pretty much between Rochester and Buffalo. And a few years ago, I encountered some geologists going across our farm. They informed me that they were tracking the Clarendon Fault.
Uh-huh.
They said said it came up from, I believe they said it came up from Pennsylvania. I don't know if they were trying to scare me or what, but I, in so many words, they told me that it was quite, it was a fault that showed a lot of activity. And as it is, they tracked it right across my farm. And I was just wondering, I'm, I subscribe to Seismowatch, and I have not received anything, any information on this current fault. Do you know anything about that?
I hadn't heard that particular fault name, but certainly the St. Lawrence zone, the lineament there, is like a finger pointing down to New Madrid, Missouri. And there have been a number of seven-magnitude quakes along that major suture. Call it a geo-suture. And it's a zone of weakness, and unusual rock types develop along it. And there have been some very destructive quakes going back into colonial times. And, of course, you mentioned Pennsylvania. You know, they had a couple of 4.6s just about 2 years ago near Harrisburg. Surprised everybody. The largest quakes in the history of Pennsylvania. And at one point, I had a list of 12 earthquakes that had been centered in Pennsylvania. All 12 of them fit my window theory.
Oh, my.
And including those in Harrisburg.
All right, so everybody needs to understand that your window applies not just to the Ring of Fire, not just to California, not just to the West Coast, but anywhere subject to earthquakes.
Well, by inspection, you can find that the Salton Sea Trough is out of phase, and that many east-west structures like the Pyrenees Mountains and the Kamchatka area where the faults are moving.
Boy, it's been really moving over there. Jim, hold on. We're at the bottom of the hour. We'll be right back. Retired California geologist Jim Berkland, my guest.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring Coast to Coast AM from the 28th of June, 1996. Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring Coast to Coast AM from June 28, 1996.
In the window, as it were, my guest is retired geologist Jim Berkland in California, the Bay Area. So, he lives in the area he talks a lot about. We'll talk more to him in a moment, or I should say you will. We'll try and get more to the phones as we can. To Jim Berkland. And Jim, very briefly, before we dive back in here, and I've got a ton of stuff for you, the phone lines are boiling. Let's do it one more time. A lot of people joined us at 1 a.m. Pacific time. We're in a window. We went into a window at midnight that extends now through July 6th, and you have a very specific set of predictions for what's going to occur between now and then, 85% probability. What is that?
Yes, four main predictions. Specific ones for time, place, and magnitude, that within 70 miles of San Jose, California, in the south end of the San Francisco Bay, I expect a 3.5 to 6 magnitude quake to occur during that time. And within 140 miles of Los Angeles, the same range and magnitude during the same period. And within 70 miles of Seattle, the same thing. Now, the Seattle one, people say, well, they just had this strongest quake in 31 years,
right,
so it's easy to hit the aftershocks. Well, my last window was opened on the 1st of June, and there hadn't been a quake stronger than 3 since the 5th of June. And on June 1st, just 20 minutes into my window, they had a 3.2, and that hasn't been exceeded since, mm-hmm, June. Then worldwide, most of the major quakes of 7 magnitude or greater, about 80% of the major quakes around the world do occur around this Pacific Ring of Fire, that world-encircling band of trenches and earth and volcanoes and larger earthquakes. And normally we get 14 major events per year, so about one a month. So with my 8-day window, I have about a 1 in 4 chance of hitting it just randomly. But I've been hitting 3 out of 4 for about 20 years, 22 Yeah,
that's quite
years.
A record, yeah.
Uh-huh. So then other seismically active areas in the world should also look to their own local effects. The tides only really tell you when. They give you an idea as to when, but they don't really tell you where or how big. And so you look at your springs or your, if you have hot springs, they may change their temperature. Often over a period of months prior to quake, the volume of water will decrease and the temperature will decrease. And then suddenly the quake will hit and you'll find the temperature is 10 or 20 degrees warmer and maybe full of H2S gas or maybe releasing a lot of radon gas that could have been detected days in advance of the earthquake.
All right.
The ground may tilt. If you're near a fault that's been known to creep, it may suddenly increase its creep rate, as the Hayward Fault has been known to do now since Christmas time. It's been creeping 30 times faster than it was for the previous 30 years.
Yeah, I heard that. And yeah. Here's the perfect place for this fax. Jim, Art, my house sits actually directly on the Hayward Fault. I was wondering if you could ask Mr. Berkland if he thinks any movement might occur on this particular fault. Thanks, Mark, KSFO, San Francisco.
If I were there, the chief movement would be me getting out.
Getting out?
I would not live on the Hayward. That's ridiculous. It moved at least 3 feet in 1836 and 1868, and it hasn't moved except by slow creep ever since. I mean, sudden movements with a close to 7-magnitude earthquakes. You do not want to have even a steel house on top of such a fault. Mother Earth doesn't respect our earthquake-proof structures.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no reason to live on such a thing. It's frightening. I would plan to move out. You're going to have to disclose the fact to somebody else, that, especially if you have young kids.
When did that come into effect, that you had to disclose? Say, by the way, you're on a fault line here.
Yeah. On my arrival into Santa Clara County in 1973, when I started, to work for the county, I found that this bill had just been adopted because largely of the San Fernando earthquake in 1971.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, hey, if your house is on a moving landslide, you have to disclose that because that's a material fact. But we had no regulations about next to a fault that's either moving or likely to move. And people always had this feeling, well, I know there's a fault around here somewhere, and not understand that they're right on top of it until the sidewalk begins to move apart.
Yes.
And, you know, this winery down south of Hollister was the first place they ever discovered creeping fault, where the fault would move without benefit of earthquakes.
So, in other words, if you lived on the Hayward Fault right now, you would not be sleeping well over the next week or so.
Oh, I would, in fact, probably want to visit someplace else for a while.
Little vacation.
If I lived 100 feet away, it wouldn't bother me, except I wouldn't want to go up and work on the chimney or something, you know. And I would tell the kids, hey, if something happens, then we have our Aunt Margaret over in Nevada. You call her, and I'll call her wherever we are when the quake hits, and we'll say, hey, we're all right. And then we'll call her back and see how the other people are doing. She's a clearinghouse.
I was passing through Anchorage after the big quake.
Mm.
I saw the effects of it. I actually saw it.
Yeah.
And I have had nightmares ever since, Jim, about the earth actually opening up, and I know it sounds dumb, but swallowing me up, falling down in a crack, and just disappearing into the earth.
Yeah, well, that doesn't happen. You get lurching in weak materials, and, of course, you had Turnagain Heights there.
I saw it could have happened in Alaska.
But not along the fault.
Yeah.
It's like a landslide.
Yeah.
This kind of thing, yeah, you can slip in, and it can move and crush you, And the houses were built pretty good on, pretty well on Turnagain Heights. They just moved around like little toys, and that whole thing moved towards the Kinnick Arm. And then did you hear what happened about 10 years ago? They decided instead of keeping that a park, they were going to go back and develop it again?
Well, people forget,
don't they? And the city council and the geologist saying, hey, what kind of a lesson does it take here?
Yeah,
and the city council person said, don't you have any faith in Alaska?
Alaska.
Totally irrelevant.
That's a great comment. Yeah. First time caller line, you're on the air with Jim Berkland. Hello.
Hi.
Hi. Howdy.
How are you guys?
Fine.
I'm calling from Bakersfield.
All right.
Boy.
And I'm wondering, you know, living in California, I've always heard about the big one. And I'm wondering, how likely is it that California will break up into small pieces and the shoreline will be Arizona?
Geologically, the chances are zero.
Okay.
If you get some other sources of information, you know, then you have to go with that. But I just totally talked that away. Down around Tehachapi and here in Altamont Pass, in the Bay Area, they have these giant wind generators.
Uh-huh.
So I've always told people, Don't worry. The minute we start to slide, they're going to turn on those propellers.
So it's a bunch of hype.
It'll pull the crust right back up into place.
All right. So you're safe, but you're not safe. How is Bakersfield?
Well,
are we under a major fault? I know San Andreas is really close.
You're close. Now, 1952.
Yeah.
On June the 21st, you know, it was summer solstice, you had a 7.7 quake up in the White Wolf Fault at the edge of the Tehachapis. And that's the largest earthquake in the state since 1906. It occurred on the day of the new moon.
Okay.
And 1 month later, we had an eclipse of the sun. And the day after that, Bakersfield had its own separate quake, essentially an aftershock, but it was on a different fault east of Bakersfield. It was a 6.0. It did more damage in Bakersfield than the Tehachapi, even though the Tehachapi was 500 times stronger. Bakersfield is certainly not immune, but definitely the structures have been improved. Boy, those old adobe structures and unreinforced masonry, those were pretty well filtered out following those earthquakes.
Mm-hmm.
You're in much better shape now than you were then. But
all right. That's a good answer. Anyway, California is not going to break off, slide off.
No way.
No way. Huh? Small portions of it may rearrange, though.
Slowly. Mm-hmm. The maximum movement we've ever had from a single earthquake, it happened twice in 1899 up in the southeastern Alaska, and again in 1964. And the up and down motion was a maximum of 47 feet displacement. Great sections of sea were raised above, and the fish were flopping, and the mussels died from the being under the land. And other great sections were dropped beneath sea level, and they had to, you know, replace the harbor of Cordova and move the city up into the hills a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And so major land effects can occur, but not turning us into a series of islands.
All right. I'm going to get to San Deo. I meant to ask you about that. But Wildcard Line, you're on the air right now with Jim Berkland. Hi.
Yes. Hi, Art.
Where are you?
Sedona, Arizona.
Oh,
wonderful.
Mystical Sedona.
My husband and I have lived here 20 years, and I can tell you, indeed, it is a magical town.
Mm. Was there 2 years ago, and our next stop was up into Walnut Canyon, which I'd never heard about before.
Oh, that's interesting.
And then I was in Meteor Crater when the first Shoemaker Levy began to hit Jupiter.
Uh-huh.
Very good timing for me.
Oh, good. Art, I'm a big fan of yours for a couple of years, so I'm thrilled to get through tonight.
Great.
Thank you.
I want to tell you that I've got a question to ask, but first of all, I want to tell you about animals.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Our dog, she's half dingo, by the way. I'm originally from Australia.
Oh.
We have a lot of dingoes in Arizona. She's very, very restless.
Tonight.
The last few days.
Uh-huh.
Follows me from room to room. She's never done that before. Creeping from the living room into the bedroom to sleep at night. She comes in little stages, like little sneaking in, you know?
Uh-huh.
And put her back to bed, and she's right back again. And today she was following me around the house. I didn't know why. And also, our birds are very timid. When I'm coming up to the front door of our house, there's a lot of birds always around the front on our lawn. I can walk almost up to them, and a few of them I walked up to tonight when we came in, and I thought maybe one of them was injured because it wasn't moving away.
I'm getting closer to the birds. Look, I've got to stop both of you right now, and I've got to tell you, Jim, this is the truth. Yesterday, I don't know why, I walked outside. I've built this new little spa room out back. And I walked outside, and there was a bird just sitting there next to the concrete, newly poured concrete. And I walked up to the bird, and I fully expected it to get up and fly away. It didn't. It didn't fly away.
Mm-hmm.
And I reached down, and I said, "Hi, little bird." Sounds dumb, I know, but that's what I said. "Hi, little bird." And he didn't budge. But I could see he was alive.
Huh.
Jim, I reached down, and I petted the bird. And he just looked up at me, and I finally carried him over to another area. I thought I'd put him near one of our bushes, and eventually, I sat there and watched. There was nothing wrong with this bird. He flew away. But why would a wild bird allow you to come up and pet him?
Well, that's the kind of reaction that you read about in the book When the Snake's Awake by Helmut Tribuch. Now, this is the Bible when it comes to bioseismic effects. And I just, anybody can get hold of that in the library, and I hope they reprint it. In soft cover, it was only about a $10 book. He could not publish in this country because they said it's full of anecdotes and a bunch of old wives' tales. So he published in his native German. It was so good that the Massachusetts Institute of Technology Press translated it and made it available to us, and it is fantastic. And it explains, you know, about the magnetic field changes and the earthquake fogs, earthquake lights, earthquake sounds. All of these things are real, and they were totally discredited by, you know, high science for many years.
Mm-hmm.
The fellow that called in from Colorado may or may not know about the controversy in the early 60s. 1962, Colorado began to shake with over 700 earthquakes over the next 5 years.
Yes.
And they'd never felt a quake before. Well, it happened to be just about 2 months after they started pumping in this tremendous mass chemical warfare waste. They were trying to pump down these 12,000-foot holes near Colorado, near Denver.
Great.
And it went down through the upper Paleozoic rocks down into the basement below, which they thought was perfectly safe, out of sight, out of mind. And all of a sudden, the quakes began and began to do some damage. And one lone geologist, David Evans, I don't know if he's still alive, spoke up and he said, you know, we didn't have these quakes till they started pumping that water down there. I think it's kind of lubricating the faults and increasing the pore pressure and creating earthquakes. And the high scientists denied it. Absolutely not. Do you realize that's like saying we could raise the Rockies with an eyedropper?
Yeah,
so then they had to shut the pumps down for maintenance, and the earthquakes stopped.
Wow.
And after a few weeks, they started them up again, and the quakes began after a lag time of a few days. And then they said, oh, we thought so all the time. So now it's become, you know, known worldwide. You can cause earthquakes by changing the water, the fluid pressure.
All right, let me talk for a second, because I promised to do it, about Stan Deo in Australia. Stan has stayed very close to us. He's a great guy. He has been looking at these naval satellite photographs, heat imaging photographs.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And he has been making predictions based on what he calls heat plumes that show up on the satellite imagery. And inevitably, where it gets hot and then hotter and hotter, he predicts a quake, and sure enough, something happens on a fairly regular basis. His prediction, even though he's not been doing it for a long time, he's been very accurate. Would you think there might be something to that?
Well, something. We know that subsea volcanoes cause thermal currents and sometimes ash and steam to come to the surface and create new islands. We know the oceanic ridges are the source of the new magma coming up. I would think that if, on a worldwide basis, within, you know, 70% of the world is water.
That's right.
And miles deep, that it would be hard to see what's happening with the crust below over broad areas, not just over volcanic vents. And I would like to know what resulted earlier this month here, in the Mid-Atlantic Ridge.
Mm-hmm.
The 7-magnitude quake on the 2nd of June was the largest ever measured in that area, just north of Brazil and the Guianas.
Yes.
So I would like to know if there was a remarkable heat flow in the days and weeks prior to that. That would be a unique event, whereas most of our big quakes are around the Pacific anyway.
All right. Well, we can certainly find out for you.
Uh-huh.
We can certainly find out for you. All right. Let's. We've got a couple more calls here. In fact, the whole bank is going crazy, so we better try to take care of them. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Jim Berkland. Hello.
Hey, yes, this is Brad in St. Joseph, Missouri.
Yes, uh-huh. Hi, Brad.
Just there last year.
Great.
Pony Express.
Oh, yes.
Uh-huh.
Okay, I don't know about that part of the Farm Belt, but we're getting flooded out.
Ah.
My question was, though, a few years ago when I was in high school, they were preparing us for an earthquake that somebody had announced was going to come.
Ivan Browning.
Huh?
Ivan Browning.
Yes.
A geographer, a meteorologist.
Yes, we were. I mean, they crammed us through all the earthquake drills you could think of.
See, that's helpful as long as it wasn't creating any panic.
Well, I'm afraid it was. That's all that was on the news, and everybody figured the housing that was around here couldn't handle it, and we were all going to be homeless.
Well, I understand they called up the National Guard, and they had the school holiday.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, they did.
Yeah. Now, the local paper was, in Memphis. They were sending me, the radio station was sending me the paper so I could count the animals down there. And they did reach a high, but you had about a 5-magnitude quake a couple of months in advance of that December date.
In St. Joe, Missouri?
Near New Madrid. In Missouri.
Yeah, it
was in September, and they said, boy, we're getting close to the December critical date, and maybe he's right. Now, Ivan Browning was also looking at tides from the sun and moon, but he went way overboard on the data because he was calling for a particular place to have this almost unprecedented earthquake a year in advance, and you can't. There's no way you can logically do that. You don't know if that area is susceptible to a big, big earthquake, especially at the time that you've selected a year in advance.
So that was a big, big miss is what it was.
Yes, and Unsolved Mysteries came out and interviewed me about that.
Well, they
and
did?
And I told them I didn't put any credence in it. I gave it less than one-half of 1% chance of happening, and they didn't want to hear that, and I got left on the cutting room floor.
Uh-huh. Well, those things happen when you're not saying what they want to hear. Well, East of the Rockies, you're on the air with geologist Jim Berglund. Hi.
Good morning, Mr. Bell.
Good morning. Where are you?
I'm in Windsor, Ontario.
All right.
Great. Head up that way.
Pardon me?
Head up that way next week to Montreal.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, what I was doing, I was listening to you talk about the Yucca, the hills area where you put a nuclear depository
in there. Yes.
Well, they're doing the same thing here in Canada.
Are they?
And they've got an environment, like I was just looking at when you mentioned that, I pulled out this environmental impact statement. And it shows a seismic map of Canada and part of the United States. And the area that they show that they want to put this thing in is on the Canadian Shield near, in the Hudson's Bay area.
Mm-hmm.
And on this map, there's absolutely no seismic activity except for a few little things. But everywhere else, all
the way around. That matches everything I know about the area. Yeah, if you had to have that site, that nuclear waste site, the Canadian Shield is the best probably in the world.
Yeah.
Maybe Central Australia would match it.
So this map would be correct then?
As far as I know, as long as you get away from the St. Lawrence Seaway.
Yeah.
And up in Northwest Territories, they've had some very large earthquakes. But around the Hudson Bay, it's been pretty cool.
There you are, sir. All right?
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you very much for the call. And what we're going to have to do is pause here. Are you... You sound very much awake, Jim. Are you still?
Very much so. Oh, boy. I have a cup of coffee here, by the way. So.
Oh, you do?
Oh, yeah.
All right. Well, then in that case, I would suggest you sit tight, and we'll come back to you after the top of the hour and touch on so much more that's sitting here waiting. I mean, the facts.
Oh, I've got some stories that won't quit.
All right. Stay right where you are.
This is Premier Networks. That was Art Bell hosting Coast to Coast AM on this Somewhere in Time. Somewhere in Time with Art Bell continues, courtesy of Premier Networks.
There are a lot of things that we don't understand about magnetism, gravity, earthquakes, the world we live upon. And Jim Berglund is a guy who makes sense of some of it. I will try and make sense of a little bit of it for you here. Back now to Jim Berglund. Jim, are you there? Jim? Hello, Jim. Uh-oh. Uh-oh, he says. We might have lost Jim. No, we haven't.
Yep.
Here he is. There you are.
Okay.
I thought we lost you.
No.
Maybe a shaker.
I hope so.
Now don't. You're not supposed to say that.
For little ones, Joe. I love them.
The little ones. Yeah, the little ones. But you are predicting actually three... What would you call those? They're not
moderate
earthquakes.
Mm-hmm.
Do you love those? Be honest.
Yeah.
You might even love the big ones, but you wouldn't probably say you.
Well,
love them.
I wouldn't like to go through Loma Prieta again in that situation where I wasn't sure the building was going to stand up.
I hear you. All right. So many people want to talk to you. First time caller line. You're on the air with Jim Berglund. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. Where are you?
I am in Minneapolis.
Minneapolis.
Oh,
all
boy.
Right. All right.
I enjoy your program very much, but I do work daily, so I don't get to watch, listen to very often. What I was concerned about was I'm flying into San Jose Sunday for trial on Monday.
Well, you can sure pick your times.
I know. That's why I just happened to hear this tonight, and I was wondering, you just said moderate. Now, mm-hmm. What do you mean by moderate?
Well, most likely it's not going to be over a 5.
Okay.
Most people are going to survive anyway. You just don't want to take unusual chances. San Jose did quite well, really, in the Loma Prieta quake. We had no deaths, and there were some locally poorly situated houses that had a lot of shaking. Our house here, we lost about 2 feet out of the swimming pool.
Mm.
Oh.
We're not going to worry about that now because we filled it in after the kids grew up, and we have a lawn on top of where the pool was, so we're not going to have any more water sloshing out. There was a water polo team at West Valley College that all got swept up on the bank as the big sage wave shook out about 10 feet of water. They were much closer to the fault. Half of them hung onto the hurricane fence there, and the other half said, "Surf's up," and jump back in the pool to share in the sloshing.
I'm not sure you're being much comfort there.
Now, comfort this lady. If she's coming to San Jose on Sunday, right in the middle of the window, the full moon, all the rest of it, where would she best be should there be an earthquake? I mean,
well,
obviously you stay out of great big tall buildings.
Well,
San Jose has grown up remarkably in the last 10 years in modern buildings. I didn't hear of any of them having any problem with the Loma Prieta quake, and I don't expect anything that strong.
All right, so come west and enjoy
absolutely.
Yourself. I mean,
thank you.
It's part of what you live with when you live in the West, right?
Sure. Yeah. If I'm going to Minneapolis in the wintertime, I'm going to dress pretty warmly.
There you go. So if you come to California,
keep a loose attitude.
A loose attitude. Well, you'll fit right in. All right, Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Jim Berkland. Hello.
Oh, Mr. Berkland, this is James in San Francisco.
Hi.
I'm an astrologer, and I've noted that the full moon Sunday night is going to be conjunct Jupiter. I find that significant. You don't.
True.
Okay.
What, Jupiter has about 1,000th the
Jupiter is a powerful planet.
Now,
we'll see what happens.
Wait a minute. Now, what he's saying is scientifically accurate. In other words, the actual effect from Jupiter as compared to the moon.
Yeah. Well, if you look up right now, you'll see Jupiter and the moon right together. Tomorrow, Sunday night, they're going to be 40 degrees apart after sunset.
Yeah, but so what?
Oh, because Jupiter has a pull like all the planets.
Well, what happened the last time you had conjunct the moon and Jupiter?
Well, we have them every month, but we don't have them on a full moon on perigee, and with the tides going up and the dogs going off, the magnet's coming off.
Okay.
What I want to say is, Mr.
So you're hitching a ride.
Yeah, Mr. Bruce Cathy of New Zealand talks about the world grid system, and he doesn't talk about tectonic plates. The Russians talk about it, too.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like Plato talked about the hull of the sphere, which is a dodecahedron.
Well, I believe in Hoagland's 19.5 degrees. There's no getting around it.
Yes.
Oh, would you like to comment on Mr. Hoagland's 19.5?
Yeah. In fact, I called him when I suddenly noticed that the giant crater in Yucatan is at 19.5 degrees, and none of his publications had talked about that. And he says, now that is interesting.
Really?
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, I've got a call into Richard. I think he's back from Europe, or he might be taking off again. I'm not sure. But... he is intriguingly he's just a very interesting person to listen to, and I'm beginning to buy into an awful lot of what he says.
Yeah, he talked me into going back to Wyoming to the CODI conference a couple years ago, and I gave a paper on the face on Mars, wondering why my other geologic colleagues weren't saying, hey, this thing doesn't look natural.
Uh-huh.
And I, about 90% convinced it's not natural. It's about the size and shape of Ayers Rock in Australia. And in the 40s, there was a Japanese architect who suggested we make a giant face staring up for extraterrestrials to have a look. You know, there's somebody here.
Yes.
A nose a mile long. So not too far off from Earthling concept.
There was a program called The Mysterious Origins of Mankind. Did you see that?
I think I may have seen one or two.
All right. Well, it proposed a theory that suggests that there is, at various times, gigantic
hostile movement that that everything shifts. That
yeah.
you know, and that they have found a vegetation up at the North Pole and so forth and so on.
No, yeah, well, I worked north of the Arctic Circle in the Brooks Range, and there were poppies and buttercups and everything growing in the hills, and right next to the glaciers and the frozen ground. Permafrost is right there, about 2 feet down.
Mm.
So you can just picture an elephant wandering around and slipping into some sludge and getting frozen rather quickly, even with the buttercups in his stomach. It doesn't mean he lived in a temperate climate. And if he did, why did he need all the hair? And why did you have the woolly rhinoceroses and all this stuff? So, yeah, Sandberg, or Ivan Sanderson, and I guess Casey and a few others talk about this massive displacement.
Yes.
Hapgood is another leading proponent. And there's no question the magnetic field, the magnetic pole moves slowly around, absolutely. But we've never had any indication of a sudden shift of the crust itself.
So you generally reject that?
Absolutely.
All right. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Jim Berkland. Hi.
This is Sunshine, and your guest, very interesting. When you spoke of the bird,
yes.
that you were able to pet the bird.
Yes.
They have proven through research that dogs and cats, and it could, I suppose it could mean birds also, breed like an MRI. You know how an MRI
sure.
does the colorization? Well, they see the heat part of us radiating and know whether it's we're okay or not, etc.
That may be.
And I wonder if, regarding earthquakes, if they feel certain things in the atmosphere to know exactly what it is.
All right.
I think they're kind of stunned. There was a lady that had a seeing eye dog, a German Shepherd, and I've heard this now two other times. The night before a strong earthquake, the quakes over in Livermore, her dog developed convulsions, and she thought she was going to lose him. The vet couldn't see what was wrong, and then after a few hours, he was okay. The next morning, she walked out for her morning walk. She opened up the front door,
mm-hmm.
and she said it was like almost like opening up an oven door. I felt as if the air were layered. It felt like it had a texture to it. I don't know how to describe it, she said. And then the quake happened. And about 2 months later, she had moved to another locality south of San Francisco, and they had a 3.8. And I called her, and she said he had convulsions the night before that one, too. And then I just read from a seismologist in Mexico City that before the big Mexico quake in 1985, his German Shepherd had convulsions the night before, and he never could understand it. There's electromagnetic energy out there, and it's affecting our nervous systems.
I believe that's true. I firmly believe that's true. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Jim Berkland. Hi. Where are you, please?
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. Tullahoma, Tennessee.
All right.
Well, number one, I want to ask about the names of those authors, but first of all, he spoke about the New Madrid Fault. Mm. I have a daughter that lives about 25 miles from Real Foot Lake.
Oh, yes.
And you said 25% chance, but did you say no prediction for the magnitude?
Oh, probably a 3 magnitude, 3 to 4.
3 to 4.
Yeah. No reason to think larger unless you had some local indicators.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, of course, the Real Foot Lake was created when the meander of the Mississippi was cut off by the quake.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
It filled the lake.
Yeah, it was already full. It just cut it off so it couldn't continue to flow. Yeah.
I wanted to ask the name of the author of the lunar effect. I didn't get
that. Dr. Arnold Lieber,
L-I-E-B-E-R. L-I-E-B-E-R. Would I find that in the library?
If you're lucky. It came out about
1979.
And what I liked about it, too, in the back, in the glossary, it has a list of all of the phases of the moon until about the year 2006 or something like that.
Oh, well, that's great.
Uh-huh.
And the last name of when the snakes awake. It was Helmut.
Helmut Tribuch. And he actually, he lectured here at Stanford for a semester, and I didn't find out about it until he left. I'm just kicking myself I didn't get a chance to talk to him, because he is just a classic scientist, and took an awful lot of guff from people that had no right to.
Would
Yeah.
Well, this is such an interesting show, I think. But I want you to spell that last name for me.
T-R-I-B-U-T.
B-U-T.
S-C-H. Tribute.
S-C-H.
While you're at it, let me talk to the author, Thurston Clark. Thurston Clark, C-L-A-R-K-E, who got a Guggenheim and got a National Geographic Award for previous books. He's recently come out with a book called California Fault.
Okay.
And he starts at the north end of the San Andreas and works his way clear down to about the Mexican border, talking to people such as myself. I've got a large part of the chapter in there. And interviews predictors and cultists and historians. It's a really an excellent sociological study. And if you want to get to the right to the trace, it's chapter 28, Lost Cats and Smashed Pigeons.
Nah.
Chapter 28.
Yeah.
All right, there you are, ma'am.
Well, I thank you so much, and it's really interesting.
Thank you. Yes, it is. All right, here's one for you. Jim, if time allows, could you tackle this one? Assuming your hypothesis that water table hydraulic pressure frees up the plates, would the drastic lowering of the water table in Central California, especially the San Joaquin Valley, cause the area to act optimistically as an anchor or pessimistically as a pivot?
Oh, no, I can't see it at all. This was written up in We Are the Earthquake Generation by Jeffrey Goodman, and he referred to the San Joaquin Valley as moving up and down, I guess, dozens of feet.
Hmm.
I worked there with the Bureau of Reclamation for about 3 years, and there's two kinds of subsidence going on. A shallow subsidence caused by dry soils getting saturated, and they just collapse. And that causes up to 20 or 30 feet of subsidence, along with the pulling out the deep water table from the farmers and ranchers. And that also adds to groundwater table reduction and the surface dropping along with it. So those two main kinds of subsidence create big problems for canals and topographic surveys and everything else through there, but they're not... It'll have nothing to do with the plates. The theory that I talk about is that the fault lines, the shallow, relatively shallow fault lines, are where the water collects and increases the pressure.
Okay.
But it has very little to do with the plate movements, which are thousands of miles across.
Okay, I've got you. Quick shift. I cannot not ask you about the swarming of quakes at Mammoth.
Oh, boy.
Yes.
Yeah.
And they seem to come in waves, don't they?
Mm-hmm. Yes, they do. It's caused, again, a D-level alert from the USGS. They've had one as strong as the over 4 magnitude. So far, none of their alerts have turned out to be, you know...
But one of these days,
earthquakes or anything.
One of these days, what's liable to happen there?
Well, we know 600,000 years ago, there was probably one of the largest eruptions that ever hit the Earth, and about a... several thousand feet of Bishop Tuff flowed out, and ash was carried into the sky and left about 6 inches thick over Nebraska.
Good Lord.
And it would have put Mount St. Helens and Pinatubo and everything else to shame. But just the quakes themselves aren't enough to really, shouldn't alarm anyone. It's if the ground begins to swell and the heat begins to build. And the earthquake foci, the center where the earthquakes begin, gets progressively shallower.
Now, I don't know a lot about what you're talking about, but I know that if the ground began to swell,
yeah,
that's really bad.
Yeah.
Really bad.
And it was doing that 10 years ago, I guess 1980, when they had a series of 6 magnitude quakes at the same time as Mount St. Helens erupted.
Uh-huh.
And I think there was some relationship there.
I wouldn't like that. I wouldn't like ground swelling. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Jim Berkland. Hi.
Hello.
Hello.
Hey.
My name is Denise. I'm from Washington State.
Hi.
Thank you very much, Art. I love your program.
Thank you.
And my question is I truly believe, and I told a lot of friends, I happen to have a lot of dreams.
Uh-huh.
And I almost, when we had the San Francisco earthquake several years ago,
yeah.
We were living in California, Southern California at the time. For over 2 weeks, I was having tremendous dreams. I couldn't even close my eyes without seeing earthquakes.
Hmm.
About 4 days before the earthquake hit in San Francisco, I told my husband, you can't go on your trip. And he was going down to San Jose. I says, because I know it's in San Francisco and you can't go. And it's just so funny because it happened the day before he was going to leave. Of course, he didn't go because he freaked out. But anyway, I've lived in Washington State here 2 years. And in December, I was telling everybody that I think this coming year is going to be a very active one for Washington. And I even took out earthquake insurance at my house this year.
Well, that's putting your money. That's putting your money where your dreams are.
Yeah. Well, did you put in about the flooding? Your floods of the century this last winter.
Yes, I know. And one of the reasons why I think we've been having a lot of floodings is a few several months back, Art had a gentleman on or a whole bunch of people talking about. Remember when they were saying they felt that the earth shifted and all this stuff. Mm. Just about the same time the earth shifted, our weather changed dramatically here.
Well, the earth didn't shift.
Yeah, but when the talk was about.
Well, what has happened, though, is we're getting very strange jet stream patterns.
Oh, yeah.
And that accounts for where the water goes, doesn't it, Jim?
Oh, sure. That's we're the fifth wettest two-year period in the history of San Jose. And that's why when my June syzygy went out there, it was at the printers. I showed that the previous four years that double years that topped this last two, they each were accompanied by quakes of 5.5 to 7, and so I predicted we would have a 5, and it happened already in May at 4.8.
So not only do we have the moon, do we have these tidal forces all coming together at once in the window that we're in right now, but we have the Northwest, which took probably the biggest soaking it's had in a long time. That's an awful lot coming together.
Oh, yes. Yeah, and the 5.5 was the strongest quake in 31 years up there. The Mount St. Helens quake, you had a quake there on, March the 20th of 1980, in the middle of a window that was just about equal to the one we're in right now. It opened on the 16th with an eclipse.
Yes.
And there was a 4.3 quake right under the volcano of Mount St. Helens, which was the strongest quake on the West Coast during my window. So I was a bit disappointed, but I was at least, pointed into Mount St. Helens. Then the next couple of days, they had a couple of other threes. 1 week later, I was being interviewed by a PBS television crew about earthquakes, and I was waving my arms around the Calaveras Fault, and we had talked for about a half hour. And as they folded up their equipment, we started back to the town. And they said, well, speaking of other things, Jim, what do you think about Mount St. Helens? And I said, I think that volcano means business. I'd give it a 50-50 chance to erupt this year and become the first one since Mount Lassen back in 1922 in the Conterminous 48.
Yikes.
They said, you hope you're right, and it began to erupt that very day.
All right, Jim, hold on. Jim Berkland is my guest. He'll be right back.
This is Premier Networks. That was Art Bell hosting Coast to Coast AM on this Somewhere in Time. Listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring Coast to Coast AM from the 28th of June, 1996.
None other like it. Wide open talk radio in the middle of the night that is not your granddad's talk radio. I guess that's one way to put it. Well, you wanted Jim Berkland, so we have had a Jim Berkland fiesta tonight is what we've had. Jim, you've really been a trooper to stay with us this long.
Pleasure.
Do you normally stay up late at night?
Yes, but and then usually I go to sleep with an earplug in my ear, tuned to your program.
Oh, you do. So you're a listener? Oh, that's cool. Listen, here's something from down in San Diego, an observation. This afternoon I was down at the beach at La Jolla. San Diego area, very exclusive, I might add, and witnessed several sea lions coming in close to the beach, which was crowded with people. One seal came up out of the water amidst a group of people, stayed on the sand, even after the children and adults formed a ring around it. The seal's behavior was very odd, very out of place, and I've not seen this occurring here before, even though I've been around these coastal waters all my life. Also, there were no gulls flying in the area.
Oh.
It was a notable absence. Also very curious, is this a possible precursor to the big one? Kurt in Encinitas.
Well, it's a clue. We would add it to the others. Now, the sea lions have been getting bolder and bolder. They're quite an attraction in San Francisco, and they're just swarming all over the boats, and that's Fisherman's Wharf.
Yes.
And now that's happened down in Monterey, where they're becoming quite a hazard. So it may be that some of these emboldened sea lions have worked their way further south. But I had a call. A lady was in Mexico, and she heard at the beach and just sunning herself by Acapulco and heard somebody yell, "Tiburon, Tiburon!" They look and they saw this dorsal fin, and it was a lone dolphin that came into this little shallow water, and a Mexican youth went over and went up to it and grabbed it by the fin and swam around with it, and everybody was taking pictures.
Uh-huh.
And it reared up out of the water and let out the most plaintive bleat. And they all were wondering about this when this 7-magnitude quake came rolling through.
Uh-huh. So the answer is maybe.
Yeah.
All right. One more, and then we'll go back to the phones. Jim, what, if any, I've wanted to ask this too, do you think the French nuclear underground testing, what effect might it have on earthquakes? And for that matter, anybody's nuclear testing, Jim, what do you think about that?
Well, when I was going to Davis, we were all up in arms about the testing up in Amchitka, with an H-bomb to create a harbor and to see what might happen and that sort of thing.
Yes.
We signed petitions, and there were like 8 government agencies, and 6 of them said don't, and the 2 that said yes were military agencies, and so, of course, they outvoted everybody else, and they went ahead with it. But for the next month, there were no quakes around the Ring of Fire to speak of. Nothing really happened. Now, there's no question that within a few tens of miles of an underground nuclear test, you often get little shifts in the crust, and you get quakes that are considerably smaller than the energy of the blast itself.
Huh.
And this has caught my attention for some time, but I don't see anything to it, although that very same Mexican quake I just talked about, that happened to be the day of one of the largest blasts they ever did underground north of Las Vegas, the Frenchman's Flat. And when I saw that, I said, uh-oh. And then I looked carefully at the times. And the earthquake came before the nuclear blast, and I didn't hear anybody say that the blast was triggered by the earthquake.
Yes, well, I've lived in this area for a long time now, and I well recall, in Las Vegas, we would give out warnings to get away from precarious positions, get off tall buildings,
yes.
All the rest of it when we'd light one, torch one off here.
Well, up around the Bay Area, I could tell when I'd hear when the blasts were supposed to go off, and so I'd have my pendulum there, and it would actually move. The house would move past the pendulum about a quarter of an inch. As it'd take about 90 seconds for the energy from that nuclear blast near Las Vegas to come up to the Bay Area.
Okay, here's one more for you. There was a kind of a secret plan talked about during the Reagan administration when we were busily arming the Contras and trying to see to it that Nicaragua had a peaceful democratic future instead of a communist one. And there was this quiet talk in the background that there was a plan to literally blast a new Panama Canal all across Nicaragua.
Yeah.
And we were going to do that with nuclear devices. What would you say of such a plan?
Well, I think we've had enough nuclear. I think we're trying to keep up with the Russians. They were going to change the course of several of their north-flowing streams to bring them to the south where they'd do some good.
Yeah.
With nuclear blasts.
Right.
And it was just like another race. I was asked to testify to the Earthquake Prediction Evaluation Council back in 1979.
Yes.
And I brought in, at the start of my talk, a whole list of scientific pronouncements over the previous 15 years that we are 10 years away from effective earthquake prediction, and the next year we're still a decade away from earthquake prediction, and it kept every year the goal would recede 10 years. And then I brought out this clipping from Russia, and it said, The Soviet scientists now believe they are 5 years away from effective earthquake prediction. And I leaned over this table with all these graybeards around, and I said, "Gentlemen, we have an earthquake prediction gap." And nobody laughed, and I realized what I was up against.
You're exactly right. First-time caller line, you're on the air with Jim Berkland. Hi.
Hi, Jim.
Hi.
Hi, this is Ann. I'm calling from Los Angeles.
Yeah.
Art, hi.
Hi.
I just tuned into your program a few weeks ago, and I find it quite intriguing, actually.
Well, it's a little different.
And can I say, you know, I'm on the artistic side of life rather than the scientific side of life, so, you know how those can clash from time to time. What I wanted to ask Jim was, there any prediction beforehand about the quake in San Francisco and the one at Northridge?
The Loma Prieta quake? Yeah, you came in late. I predicted it in the newspaper 4 days before it happened.
I've got the article here. He did.
Yeah. And I called it the World Series earthquake, and 1 week later I was called in to talk to the boss, and they wanted to fire me. I was suspended for 2.5 months for supposedly panicking the public. And I was doing my best to lay facts out. It's like, well, we know this hurricane is coming, but we don't dare tell anybody because it might excite them.
Okay, you know, I respect, you know, very much I respect everyone from every walk of life, geologists, seismologists, or whatever.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, the point you made about scaremongering, you know, that's the thing that worries me. This lady who called in who wanted to travel to
San Jose.
Up north, yeah. San Jose.
No problem.
It's 4th of July, now she's concerned about traveling.
I'm traveling myself. I'm flying out of San Jose at this time.
Yeah, but you know, she's concerned about it because, you know, she said this prediction and what have you.
Are you focusing on the higher end of the prediction? It's a 3.5 to 6. It may well be a 3.8, which you couldn't feel for more than 75 miles.
Well, that's the thing. You know, there are earthquakes in California every day virtually, you know, but most of them, you know, we don't feel, you know, most of them we're not aware of.
Well, that's a good question in itself. Where do we generally become aware? In other words, you get a 1.5?
I was awakened with a 1.9. I put an ad in the paper, and everyone that responded, there were six other people, all felt it. It was about 2 a.m. So, you know, you had to be very quiet, and you had to be within 5 miles of it to feel it.
But at beginning what? At about 3 or so?
Well, when it gets to about 3.5, you're pretty sure it's a quake. When it's 5, you have no doubt. I had immediate call after the 5.1 hit Seattle from Laura Lee. You know about Laura Lee?
Oh, sure.
Okay. And so I'd been on her show about a week earlier, and when the quake hit, the first call I got was from Laura Lee. "Jim, we just heard a big bang, and now my chandelier is kind of waving. I think we had an earthquake, but my husband just thinks a big truck went by." And I said, "It sounds like a quake to me."
Mm.
And all of a sudden, bing, I had another call, and I got the... It was another lady from Seattle who had experienced the quakes and knew it was, and they put the two of them together.
And at a 7 point or greater quake, you generally have to do the laundry?
Yeah. Well, I didn't in my case, but I came close.
All right. Wildcard line, you're on the air with Jim Berkland. Hi.
Hi, is that me?
That's you.
Wow.
Where are you?
This is Melissa, Houston.
Houston. Hi,
another
Melissa.
Another fascinating and very interesting guest, Art.
Thank you.
As always. I wanted to ask both of you if you are aware that beginning this month, the entire West Coast from Mexico to Seattle will be having a multi-jurisdictional task force exercise. Exercise 140, I think they call it.
Mm-hmm.
Really?
Yes, and it's involving, I guess, huge foreign troops that have been flying in all week into Miramar Naval Air Station and Brown Field. I don't know much about these, you know, military exercises. I think, Art, you mentioned you were in the military at one time.
I was in the Air Force, yes.
Air Force, yes.
Oh, yes.
So, I mean, I wondered if this could possibly sound like some kind of FEMA, you know, operation or something.
All right. Well, it leads to an interesting question. I don't know if that is, but, Jim, way behind the scenes, are they doing a lot of preparation and things that they don't tell us about?
I kind of have a hunch along that line. We keep having these earthquake fairs and informative seminars.
Yes.
And but it's really just logical. I really think that if the federal government could effectively predict earthquakes, they would be doing it.
Would they? Would they? Yeah, but would they really?
I mean, let's say the federal government had, through whatever resource, Jim Berkland or anybody else, had knowledge that it was going to be an 8-point quake in Los Angeles area. I think it's a big toss-up. I'm not so sure they'd tell people at all.
Well, they would at least tell the government, and they'd say cancel the leaves.
Yeah.
The elective surgeries, postpone those.
Yeah.
Open up the warehouses, get ready to move foods, check all the batteries, check the reservoirs, that sort of thing.
Yeah, but the word would get out.
Yes, and that's why I don't think they really had that. I've gotten a few rumors at times. Well, they put all the fire engines outside the fire station, which is one of the techniques. And I've heard things about moving ships and so forth. I do remember my old seismology professor, Perry Byerly at Berkeley, said one of his proudest moments is when there was some concern about an earthquake. There was a prediction.
Yes.
And they said, should we move the fleet out into the Pacific? And he felt this great sense of power that he never experienced before or since. He said, no, in the harbor is the best place to be.
Huh. I guess it would be. There'd be some protection there.
Yes. No tsunami, if there were that problem. Open sea is the best place to be for a tsunami where it's only a few feet high.
So if you were going to look for signs that they knew something we didn't know and they were getting ready for something big, what would you most look for?
Well, the reports from the wives of the workers, the word gets out in their coffee clutches and so forth. Yeah, but a lot of times, I've already had these reports. They have just been rumors. And that's one of the worst things to deal with, the rumors. I had two little old ladies call me separately after Loma Prieta.
Yes.
They had heard that the 7 was a foreshock to a 9. And I said, no. That was a classic main shock, and the aftershocks will decrease in frequency and intensity with time, and don't worry about it. The worst is over. But you need somebody to stem those rumors because they get way out of hand.
I've always wanted to know about that. Are there foreshocks? We talk about aftershocks all the time, but we don't talk so much about foreshocks.
Well,
how frequently do you have a 6-point that's followed by a 7-point?
Well, then the 6 was a foreshock, yes. But you never can recognize a foreshock until you've had the main shock. And a lot of this is, it's pretty hard to pigeonhole. About half of the California quakes of 5 magnitude or more have foreshocks.
Oh, they do?
Yeah, about half of them. And they, like that Long Beach quake in 1933, the day before, there was about a 3.8. Loma Prieta had 2 quakes of over 5 magnitude, one the year before and one 2 months before. Interesting, too, I got a call from a fellow on Santa Cruz Mountains who was bedridden. He could hardly stand for a couple of weeks prior to that quake. He moved away to get closer to a hospital, and he got better real fast. He went back on the mountain, and he had a relapse. So his friend was walking along the beach at Santa Cruz with the boyfriend, in the waves, barefooted, and all of a sudden she got this electric shock.
Wow.
And she had to get up onto the dry sand, and the foot that shock was occurring in was the foot in which a steel pin had been inserted. Now, this may explain why the snakes crawl out of the ground, and worms crawl out of the ground, and fish jump out of the water, and that sort of thing. Maybe they are stimulated electrically.
Maybe they are. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Jim Berkland. Hello.
Good morning, Art. Good morning, Jim.
Hi.
This is Smokin' Joe from Anchorage, Alaska.
All right.
Regarding the heat plumes, you know, that Stan Dale temperature anomaly, I guess it's Otis Files.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. At the moment, I've been following a couple of plumes, and I think there's one right underneath Alaska right at the moment because it's lit up all along the coastline like a corona.
Hmm.
And the other area that's lit up right now is Kamchatka.
Oh, well, yeah, they've certainly been having some big shakes there.
The other thing is, I was cruising the web pages in University of Dundee.
Yes.
And they have a 14 times. I really love that website. It's my favorite.
Huh.
There was a blurb in there. You know, it's Unexplained Phenomena website.
Yes.
And he mentioned a report of a large magnet which temporarily lost its charge.
Interesting. Yes, that's also in When the Snake's Awake. And I've had a couple call me from Pasadena that their refrigerator magnets dropped off the refrigerator the night before the Whittier earthquake.
Oh, my.
Yeah.
Cool.
That is something.
Yeah. And a jeweler in Tokyo had a big magnet hanging in his window with steel pieces to attract the public to look in and, you know, come on in.
Yes.
And all of a sudden he heard clank, 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 and he looked over and he thought the magnet lost its power, and it had temporarily, and then this big quake hit Tokyo.
My God, how could that?
Scientists say it's impossible. You know, they say it has to be in a field stronger than itself, and the Earth's magnetic is only, half a Gauss. And so,
exactly.
But as Helmut Tribbage says, stop saying it's impossible. When it keeps happening, try to explain it. I mean, come up with the positives.
East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Jim Berkland. Hi.
Good morning, Art.
Good morning. Where are you?
Good morning, Jim. This is Shane from West Texas.
Yes, sir.
Yes, I have a thought-provoking question that's been bothering me for quite some time. With the tectonic plate shifting with a continental drift, I've wondered, how is it the pyramids are still perfectly in line?
Ooh.
Because Africa has been the most stable landmass. It's sort of the central area that everything else is relative to.
Answer might be they knew where to build them.
And it has shifted a tiny bit. The pyramids are almost exactly north, south, and east-west.
Yes.
And they've explained it from being off about a half a degree or less by the movement of Africa. But there has not been much.
All right. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Jim Berkland. Not a lot of time, so we've got to do a quick one here.
We'll give it a try, okay, for San Diego.
Yes, sir.
How's the L.A. quake going to affect us?
All right. If there were a quake in L.A., how would it affect San Diego, depending on magnitude, of course, but say a 7.7?
Yeah, you're 100 miles away from downtown Los Angeles, and so the quake would have to be about a 5 before you'd even feel it. And the farther you are away from the epicenter, the more of the energy goes into these long period waves, a slow roller. You don't get the real sharp jostling and everything that you do when you're up close.
Mm-hmm.
So it's more of a entertainment.
at the expense of the people to the north. All right, Jim, we've done it, I'm afraid. We're about out of time, Jim. And I don't know what to say except, wow, what a program. It's been a real pleasure.
Well, I'll be a little bit disappointed with this exposure if we don't get some kind of jolts where I expect them.
Well, I hope you're happy, I guess. Listen.
Well, keep them small.
This program, the one we're doing right now, is going to repeat Sunday night, Monday morning.
Oh.
Oh, and then by then, we're going to have what, a full moon?
Yeah, the full moon is on the 30th, and it'll be the highest tides on the 1st.
So.
And this is, early in the window is the preferred time, and I'm really expecting to hear about a number of events.
A number of events. All right, so that we're clear, we're at the end of the program. The window is between now and the 6th of July. During that time, you said you expect with an 85% reliability factor, there will be 3 earthquakes. Give it to us again real quick.
3.5 to 6 magnitude quake in the San Jose, Los Angeles, and Seattle areas, and a major quake, a 7, around the Ring of Fire.
Someplace.
Which could possibly include the West Coast, Western America, but doesn't necessarily happen.
All right, my friend. Well, by the way, in an earthquake, Jim, are you better off in a regular bed or a water bed? I've always wondered that.
Maybe under it. I noticed that Mexico City, the desks kind of held up the ceiling. Waterbed, you get a better ride for sure. And there was a convention of doctors here when the quake hit, and they were hoping they could count on the waterbed having a similar reaction the next time they have their convention here. But
all right, my friend, listen.
Story.
That's it. We're out of time, Jim Berkland. What a pleasure. I'm going to give you the honors. Do you know what they are?
Good night, America.
Oh boy, you are a listener, Jim. Good night. Thank you. That's Jim Berkland. I'm Art Bell. This is Coast to Coast AM. Thank you all. Good night, America.